All right, so we're discussing the issue of Ma'amad Har Sinai. As to, first of all, how do we have knowledge? Since this is the foundation of our whole system, our acceptance of Torah. So how do we have knowledge today that the event took place? And for starters, why was the event itself necessary? If you go through the stories, you see that, well, first of all, you see one thing, that at no point in the Torah, at no point, is there any idea that it's meritorious or it's praiseworthy that people should accept that a certain individual is a prophet, or that they should accept that something is from God without proof? Because even before Matan Torah, when God first appeared to Moshe and instructed him to go to Mitzrayim, so Moshe had to hold the base at the snare, the burning bush. But then Moshe at one point says, "V'hein lo yaminu." They won't believe in me. But it's to say, the Rambam discusses this whole thing in the Mora, that first Moshe had to be able to convince them that he had the correct idea of God that they had. That was, they'll ask me, what's your name? I said, that's Ekya Asher Ekya. So he would be able to elucidate the concept, the idea of God that they possess. But that's not enough. If that doesn't prove, just because the person, an individual, happens to have the correct notion, the correct idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that doesn't prove that God has actually communicated with him. So that's why he said, "Vayim Vayim Inu." They'll say, "God didn't speak to you." Now, right then and there, you see that there's no idea that people should accept things on the basis of faith. Because God doesn't say to him, "Well, what do you mean?" That's it, they should have faith in you. There's no such concept. It's perfectly legitimate. To the contrary, you see that God provides them with actual demonstration. So by doing so, doesn't that establish the idea that people are not expected? It would be wrong for people to simply accept somebody because of any other factor than to be demonstrated. Why should... That idea is at the bottom of what that whole discussion is about. You must deduce that. But since God didn't tell Moshe, "Forget, don't worry about that," let's see to have Aruna. And you have to assume also that the knowledge, this idea that the Jews would someday be redeemed from the Mitzrayim, that must have been passed down to them. Because that's the message he said, that God is... remember, so to speak, that God has not abandoned you, and God is going to come and save you, and all of that. That was the message he brought to them. That message itself must have resonated with them, must have had some, which, you know, they had traditions that they had received. But that didn't mean anything. The question would be, which was a legitimate question, how do we know that God spoke to you, Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe. So, that right then and there, the fact God gave you three signs to demonstrate that that he was indeed in contact with the Supreme Being, because otherwise how could he be responsible? How could he predict the phenomenon? So you want to use the word perform the miracles, whatever. By performing the miracles, he wasn't saying that he had a specific power. It was, as we pointed out many times, the fact that he could predict at what point in time this change in nature would take place. It means that he's in contact with the Supreme Being. After that point, you see there's a certain development in terms of the relationship between Moshe and the Jews in the tribe. That they accepted what he said, and they, you know, the tide seems to go up and back. When things went badly, it was Paro, and Paro increased the work, so they turned against Moshe. And that's understandable. But eventually, in the course of the year, it's about a year, approximately a year, that Moshe spent in Mitzrayim, with the Machos, with the weakening of the Mitzrayim, and the complete change in attitude that took place towards the Jews, Chayin Ha'am, the people had a new respect for the Mitzrayim. The Mitzrayim had a new respect for the Jews, and Moshe Rabbeinu, and then you see that they rallied behind Moshe. And they had the courage to take the staff when they were commanded to, for the Korban Pesach, and to ask the Mitzrayim, as they were instructed to, for the gift. and to line up, to get ready and to actually leave the Yad Rama with a high hand. And then all the subsequent to that, all the things that took place in the Midbar before Sinai. Moshe had to perform another miracle, but it would seem that the most significant of all of them was the miracle of the Kriya Shamsa. And by the way, before that, when God tells them to turn around and go back to the Achiros, and it says that the Jews did all of that, so Rashi points out that to teach you there, to compliment them, that's their praise, that in spite of the fact that they were going towards the enemy, they still said, we have nothing except the word of Moshe. That shows that they had fully accepted the idea that Moshe was the Navi of Hashem. So, for all of these reasons, the question then arises, so why wasn't that enough? And then God asked them, said Moshe to ask them if they wanted to receive the Torah. And they said yes, without condition. Nevertheless, that was not enough. And God said, I'm going to come to you in a thick cloud, thickness of cloud, so that the people will hear. And when I speak with you, and also in you, they will believe la'olah. So that question itself is giving us the basic objective, the basic purpose of what the Ma'amah, the revelation itself, was all about. I said, the first question is that if we assume that the Jews already believed in God and believed in Moshe, so wouldn't this entire demonstration be superfluous? Now, the Rambam explains the reason why it was necessary and what the purpose is. And basically, it would seem that there are two reasons why the revelation, in which they saw these tremendous sights and sounds and so forth, everything which they perceived to be supernatural phenomena, that is, things that could not have been arranged, orchestrated by people, and most significant, they heard the voice of God from heaven. They heard a voice from heaven, which they were convinced was not a human voice, and it was commanding them in these ideas, in these mitzvot. So there are two factors. One factor is that a person who believes on the basis of miracles, that belief in and of itself is not perfect. The Rambam says it's sort of like Yesh Acharei Hashira. It's not completely convincing. It has an effect. You see, it's not to be completely dismissed, because on the basis of these miracles, the Jews did follow Moshe Rabbeinu. But it means to say it's rational, that if you were in that situation, and Moshe had performed these various miracles, so it would make sense to follow, which the Jews did. But in terms of giving the Torah and producing an absolute conviction, so miracles, even the greatest of them, seem to be lacking something, and that was one of the reasons why Ma'aman Har Sinai is going to restore that which would be lacking in ordinary miracles. Miracles, in general, while they make a very powerful impact upon a person, generally speaking, they don't produce anything which is lasting. Because you have to understand there's a lot of resistance in the human psyche. There's a lot of resistance. And after time, you can sort of like rationalize what this was. Because it depends upon a certain type of an association. You never really, it doesn't satisfy the mind completely, because you're just making a certain assumption that this is not a coincidence. That you were in a desperate situation and had given up all hope, and then a certain event had occurred, so you're making a certain deduction, that therefore there must be a God, and so on and so forth. But you never really get direct access to that. That's by inference. It's an inference that the mind makes. And it's a correct inference, but it's logical. You don't know if it's correct. You don't know if it's correct, but it's logical. Given all the circumstances, sir. Given those circumstances, if you were in a situation like that where you were facing tremendous danger of you being overwhelmed by enemy forces, and then somebody came along and told you not to worry, everything will be okay, you will see, in 1 hour's time, there's going to be an earthquake on that side, and it will be consumed, you know, that type of thing. If you were to see all of that, there's no question that it would make a tremendous impact upon you, and if you function purely intelligently, you'd assume, you'd say you'd do less. It doesn't make sense to assume that it's a chance phenomenon, and you deduce, therefore, that there must be a supreme, there must be this, there must be this, there must be that. But don't you understand, that depends upon a person who's very, very rational, but because of the fact that you have to make all of those steps, and those steps that you're making are not things that you are witnessing directly, you're not witnessing the underlying cause behind it, it's because of the way the psyche is structured emotionally, it leaves room for doubt, so that when other emotions come to the fore, and now you have desires, which would be contrary to the truth that you'd have to live by if all of those deductions were actually true. So then you see the emotions begin to overpower a person. Yeah, well, you know, who knows? Maybe it was a coincidence. Maybe this person knew about the geological factors. Even though that is irrational, even though it would be irrational, put it that way, because you just, whatever is the logical conclusion, whatever the logical conclusion should be, is one that you should actually live by. But the nature of Adam is that he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that, and when there is a powerful urge to act in accordance with certain instincts, and however, there's another part of him which is saying, no, I have to fear God. I'm violating what God has commanded. So then you have the phenomenon of the rationalization and the distortion factor begins to play. You see how people can distort reality. So there is a difference then between a situation where you arrive at the idea of a supreme being through certain influences, as opposed to where you come in direct contact. That is, the supreme being manifests itself directly, and if you're not basing yourself on the fact that how could this event occur unless it was a supreme being, you're face to face. That's what Moshe tells the Jews in the Vermont. God spoke to you directly. And that's the appeal. The appeal of the Torah really rests on this, that you must keep the Torah because you have direct knowledge that it was given to you by God. Nowhere does Moshe ever appeal to the Jews to keep the Torah because you just should have faith. No, it says that not just our fathers, but we ourselves. And that's the idea, in my opinion, that all the Jews, the souls of all the Jews in Mount Sinai, need to say that God created this event, and it was worked out in such a way that it would provide absolute proof that the Torah comes from God, not just for those people who witnessed it. That's step one. Step one is you need to know why it is that it was necessary for those people who witnessed it when they had witnessed so many other miraculous phenomena. In evaluating what the Jews actually witnessed at Sinai, they witnessed supernatural phenomena. They witnessed supernatural phenomena, and they heard a voice which they were convinced, whoever was there would have been convinced, came from God, addressing them, that this is my will. I am the Lord your God. So therefore, that teaches you all these vital points. I'll get into when we do the actual study of Biblical, we'll get into the idea of Anokhi Hashem Elokecha, what the concept is. But bear in mind that even today, I don't think it's possible to have such a phenomenal spectacle to get an entire nation, millions of people, and have a situation where they themselves will walk away convinced that they just had an encounter with the supreme being. And this is in the age of technology. See, people have a tremendous... You'll understand why there's a significance. The importance of this proof is, even upon hearing this proof, you see how people rationalize and try to distort it and try and spin it around and negate its significance. Oh, well, you know, this is a 2000, maybe they were so primitive, maybe, you know, like they were frightened, maybe there was really a volcano, all that kind of stuff. And first of all, you have to realize, I don't think that modern technology could create a thing like this. Today, with all the technologies that we have, you could not take people and convince them that they had, because people was, that they had witnessed something. You know, you can make all kinds of fireworks and displays and so on and so forth, but people witnessing it would know, would be able to recognize that this is a production. But certainly in those days, they didn't have that kind of capacity. There was no technology. So nobody could believe it. You read the story in the Torah itself. Right, a lot of people say, oh, of course, I mean, if I were there, of course I would, those people that were there, yeah, of course, but I'm not there. But if you read the description of what actually transpired, and you put yourself in that situation, and you still would not be convinced, then there's nothing to be said. I mean, the Torah is not speaking to a person like that. This is, that would imply that such an individual was like, you know, had some kind of a distortion. Could not, a person that was there, that was at Sinai and witnessed what he witnessed and heard what he heard and just negated it, that person, has a problem. If you read the description in the Varm, the people were clearly convinced that it came from God, because then they say they got a Moshe, and they say, we can't, if we continue, now we see that a person can hear the voice of God and live. That's what they say to Moshe Rabbeinu. And then they say, now you go, and if we continue to hear this, then we'll die. They were afraid that they would die, because it produced such a powerful impact upon them. To be in that state of proximity to God was such that they can only bear so much. And they said, now that's it. It's fulfilled its objective. It is now we don't need to be hearing the Torah anymore directly from God. We have absolute conviction that you, that you're the one. Because they saw that Moshe was unique, that God addressed himself to Moshe. Moshe went into the Arafel and so forth. So that was another one of the objectives. There were two objectives. One is that the Torah comes with that example. The second one is Gam B'chol Yamim Yolo. Well, God is not going to come to the Jews every day with messages. It's going to be through the ones who he has determined, his chosen one, so to speak, the Nevi'im, and then followed by the Balei HaMasorah, all the other Nevi'im, and the Balei HaMasorah, and so on and so forth. But God established a system by which the Jews would constantly be receiving, you know, his prophecy, the message that God wanted them to have, and also the interpretation, the legitimate interpretation. And you see that was fulfilled, because in Devarim, Moshe tells them that you came to me and you, that's it, you started to had enough. The first objective then was that the people itself should base their acceptance of the Torah not merely on the fact that miraculous phenomena had been performed, but rather direct communication from the Supreme Being. A second point that's made by the Rambam and the Ramban also is that by establishing the foundation this way, the Jews, as opposed to miracles, the Jews were thereby protected against the possibility of a false prophet. There's a false prophet ever coming along and undermining the foundations of Yahadus. That is to say, if our acceptance of the veracity of Torah was based upon the fact that the one who gave it to us was able to perform miracles, so we accept it because of the miracles that he performed. So then, there's a portion of the Torah that warns against the false prophet. That if a prophet should ever arise, a Navi Sheker, and he tells you something which is contrary to Torah, that God is commanding you to do something which is contrary to Torah. Now, let's assume that he performed great miracles. So you question, you doubt him, and so you're not just going to accept it. And you'll tell him, well, we can't believe you because we accept the Torah because we know the Torah comes from God, so you have to be false. So let's say it was based upon miracles. The foundation was just miracles. So then you would say, well, how do you know that what you were told then is true? And you would say, well, because of the miracles. So then, they offer for miracles first. So let's say for whatever reason, he's able to perform miracles. So now you'd be in a real dilemma. Because, well, how do you know that the Torah of Moshe is to be accepted over him? Let's assume that his miracles are equally impressive. Let's assume he can split a sea. Or whatever it is you want to put into the text. Now the Torah maintains that a thing like that is possible. But the rest, how is it possible? There's no human being. Either a person is tremendously gifted and can create illusions and fool you. That's one possibility. That somebody should develop this tremendous skill of making something appear. And today, with, you know, illusions, they can really create these kinds of impressions. Or else, it's possible that God is testing you. That's what the Rambam says. That God is testing you. So that it is possible that a false prophet, should arise and try to dissuade us or try to convince us, seduce us into some type of a practice which would be contrary to Torah. It could be something which would be idolatrous. So we should make some kind of an image and put it up in these synagogues, and not to pray to an image, but we should have that thought in mind when we do see it. Something which would be on the verge of idolatry, whatever it is. It could be totally, absolutely contrary to Torah. Now, if the foundation of Torah itself was, we believe it because the one who gave it to us performed the miracles, so now you'd be in a state of tremendous vulnerability. Because if somebody else should ever come along and create the same type of miracles, or impress us that he had created the same type of miracles, with a message that's contrary, so then how would you know who to follow? You could not refute the false prophet. It wouldn't make any sense. Why would he be a false prophet? Maybe the first prophet is false. They both do the miracles. It was a difference. The only reason you believe the first one is because of miracles. Now, he did miracles. So the first one says that what the second person is saying is false. Yeah, but by the same token, the second one is saying that God never commanded that. So you'd be stuck. So the Rambam compares this to the case of witnesses, of agents. Well, the Torah commands us that we have to decide cases on the basis of agents. And of course, you have to go through all the interrogations and so on and so forth to make sure that they're not lying. But once the witnesses have passed the test, the interrogations, so then you have to accept their testimony and you have to decide the case on the basis of their testimony. Now, does that mean to say that just because you weren't able to break them down and they passed the test of the breach of Hokira, does that mean that they're telling the truth? No. It's a halacha. It's a halacha because it's possible that they're lying, but they're very adept, they're very skillful, very, very knowledgeable, and they're able to fool the justices. The judges. That's why if the second pair of witnesses comes along and contradicts the first, so then you don't know who's telling the truth. You have to throw the case out. However, the only person that would be in such a situation that, let's say he accepted something and acted on the basis of testimony of witnesses, which was thoroughly investigated and so forth, and then he was convinced on that basis, and therefore they put a certain person in jail or whatever, they executed the person, whatever the case may be. Then you have two witnesses come along and testify to something the exact opposite. They contradict the testimony of the first. So now, assuming that you use the same method of interrogation with the second pair, you're in a situation as that. You have no way of knowing. Okay? That would be the same situation if we accepted Moshe on the basis of miracles. So with regard to that, we'd be just as vulnerable if somebody else came along with miracles and had a totally different message. We wouldn't know which message was true anymore. Because he only accepted the first message because of miracles. But let's say that you're the judge. It just so happens that you, who are the judge, then the two witnesses come, and they testify about something, and you yourself were there. And you yourself were there at that place, in that room, at that time, in that situation, and they claim that one person assaulted another person. So, would you, in this situation, would you accept what they say as being having validity? Just because they're witnesses? No, because you're not going to accept something, someone as a witness, when it contradicts that which you yourself saw with your own eyes. You see? So there's no way in the world, I mean, if hundreds and hundreds of witnesses came and testified about something, and you were there and you saw it yourself, so then you don't need witnesses, you don't need any proof. You know that what they're saying is false. You automatically would reject them. You wouldn't have to have an interrogation. With these people, you would not have to have an interrogation in order to prove that they're false witnesses, because you know by definition that they're false witnesses, because you were at the event itself. That's the difference over here. That in the first case, the reason why you believe the Torah of Moshe is not because of the miracles that Moshe performed. It's because you know directly. You know, you have first-hand knowledge that whatever has been commanded comes from God. So this is God's will. So now if somebody else come along and tell you that God wants something contrary, you say it has to be false because you heard directly what God wants. All right, it's a miracle. So you perform all the miracles you want. It's not, we're not accepting the Torah because of miracles. We're accepting it because we heard it, we know that it's true, because we're there ourselves. And you're not going to convince us through an inferior method about something which goes contrary to that which we witnessed ourselves. By establishing the Torah on this basis, it made us no longer vulnerable to the possibility of being seduced by a false prophet. That's why the Torah says that if such a thing should ever occur, and it's possible that there would be a phenomenon of a false prophet, that God is really testing us to see whether you truly love God. That is to say, whether your relationship to God is based upon a firm foundation of idea, of knowledge. Yes, all these things you see, the extent to which the real foundation for our acceptance of Torah is based upon the idea. And that the idea, if you need to do through miracles, is insufficient. Why the Rambam says that Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jews did not believe him because of the Osa studies that he did. And that's the Rambam talks about this in Historia Torah. Now we're in a position to understand what the necessity, what necessitated the Ma'amar Har Sinai. Because it established the conviction that the Torah comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God is the source of the Torah, and that his trusted servant, the one who's trusted, who's Ne'eman, to transmit it to us is Moshe Rabbeinu, that he's designated Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, whatever Moshe Rabbeinu tells us in the name of God, we should accept as the Torah. Now we understand why this is all necessary, because it put it on a different level of Yediyah, which was no longer subject to any kind of doubt, and which was no longer subject to any other kind of refutation. Indeed, there's only one possible way. After the Torah was given to Sinai, there'd only be one possible way for any other false prophet. That's why every, so to speak, prophet, will be false prophets of the other religions, whether it's Jesus, whether it's Muhammad, and so forth. All of the other imposters, well, I don't believe that they perform anything worse in terms of miracles. There's no evidence whatsoever that they did anything of significance. But even if they had done so, we would reject them because we would say to them, we were there. We heard God say that this is the Torah. And, after the Torah is given this way, the question, just throwing out the question in order to obtain an understanding, and the Rambam refers to it in one of his letters. Would it be now conceivable for there to be any type of a way in which we doubt, real doubt, could be established by them. Because we see that the whole purpose was to make it really beyond the realm of doubt. It's just showing you again the direction that though those people want to maintain the faith, simple faith, to the contrary, it's really knowledge, and to the extent where it's a kind of knowledge which does not lend itself to any kind of doubt whatsoever. The only way that we could ever be rendered vulnerable, and it's never happened, no one even tried to do it, is if somebody would come forth and say that it's God's will to... He couldn't say, there's nobody that could make the point that the soul was not given by God. He couldn't do that. The only thing you could say is that it was intended for a time and now there's a change. Well, which doesn't make sense either, because the Torah itself is very clear that this is forever. And why would God the change? If God had the law of the world of purpose, why would it change? How can he prove it? The only way to prove it is then take it. The Rambam reverses that. Fine, if you can demonstrate to us in the same way, if you can create the same phenomena that were the foundation for which we accepted... you can gather together millions of people. We want to hear directly from God. You see, because we heard directly from God that this is the Torah, this is God's will. And so that's why we keep the Torah, and we can't make any changes, because it comes to us from God.
So how do you know from God?
Because you were there. See that. Now, if you're claiming that was only intended to be temporary, or there's been a change of course now, and you're going a different direction, so we'll say, well, you have to prove it to us. The only way you can prove it to us could not be through miracles, but you would have to create a situation which is akin, which is analogous to the original situation, and we would hear directly from God, so then we would listen. But you see quite clearly that our history, nobody remotely ever, with all the deviations that people have sought to introduce into Torah, no one has ever remotely even wanted to get into an arena where he could do any kind of demonstration. The truth of the matter is that there's nobody that we know of that even was able to perform any kind of a miracle that we would give any credence to. And even today, you have a tremendous amount of charlatans in the area of religion in general. Miracles, people have claims to miraculous powers and all of that. Yet, there is nobody that is willing to come forth in an open manner, which the miracles of Moshe Rabbeinu were all performed openly, and we say even those miracles were not sufficient as the ultimate guarantor that the Torah is true. But what you have is everything is not hidden, and you have these people that stories that hold and projected and exaggeration and so on and so forth, so that of all of these people, and they're all far away, they all have everything in America. Miracles to us for everything in the world, but they can't make it public. And they can't do it in front of it's a secret. So what I'm saying is that all of this should be completely rejected. In terms of a real assault on the veracity of Torah, nothing of any true significance has ever been launched. Unfortunately, people in this area are completely irrational. And false religion, which tried to establish their origin in Sinai. All the natural cities, all the major religions have to go back to Sinai, because there's no way that they can make a duplication. There's no way that they can have what we would call a public revelation. That's an impossibility for people to do unless it's real. The phenomenon of a public revelation is impossible to create, and if it does exist, it must be real. Rambam says that the miracles that Moshe performed were not done to establish his veracity, to establish the truthfulness of Torah. Rather, each one was done because of the situation required. That is to say, Kriya Shamsuk was not done to establish the veracity of Moshe Rabbeinu, even though the result of that was that they believed, their belief in Moshe Rabbeinu increased. Still, that was not the purpose of the miracle. The purpose of the miracle was because of necessity. And that's all the miracles that were performed by Moshe Rabbeinu were done because of a certain necessity. For example, the man, they needed food. So the man was a great miracle. But it wasn't done to establish veracity. And that's where the Rambam learns the pasuk that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu at the very beginning, the dialogue by the snare, by the burning bush. So he said, "Botir Hashem, Yitzrayim Tavdun Esolokim Alaharazeh." And the Rambam interprets that to mean that the ultimate verification, that what you speak is really true, it comes from God, will be on Sinai. The event at Sinai, therefore, was intended to establish on a level which is beyond miracle. It is not to say that the Jews were impressed by the miracle. It is not to dismiss the significance of the miracle. The Jews did follow Moshe Rabbeinu on the basis of the fact that he performed miracles. Because that's what he asked God, the Hemoy Anilis, that they won't believe in me when I come to them and declare that I'm a prophet. So why should they believe that God spoke to me? So for that, it was necessary to provide him with supernatural phenomena, which indicated that he was connected to a source which was beyond the physical realm. So therefore, you can't dismiss miracles. And the point over here is not to dismiss miracles and say they have absolutely no value. They do have a value. And they work because as a result of the miracles, the signs that Moshe performed, and the Jews followed him, and then he went to Pharaoh. And God said, when Pharaoh demands a sign, this is what you should do. And those are the makos. The makos were not just punishments, but they were intended not as punishments, to direct his attention to the fact that there's a supreme being who rules the world with justice. There is then a certain type of an ambivalence over here with regard to miracles. So what are we saying? Is it rational to follow an individual on the basis of miracles? Or isn't it? You can't say that it's irrational. You can't say it doesn't make sense to follow a person on the basis of miracles. You can't dismiss miracles because they're an important element in the shlichus, in the mission of Moshe Rabbeinu. And as we said, that's the way God redressed Moshe's protest. He said, they won't believe in me. They won't believe that God, why should they believe that God spoke to me? Which again, you can deduce from that it is not correct, that it's not the will of God, and it's certainly not the position of Torah that people should just believe because of belief without proof. Because Moshe Rabbeinu raised the issue, the Haim Lo Yaminoi, and God did not say that they have to believe in you, tell them that they have to have a motive, that they have to have faith. There's no concept like that. God accepted the good point. Even though Chazal criticized on a different level that Moshe spoke that way to Bnei Yisrael, but they're not Maminim. But that's a different idea. That's on the level of Chazal. Plain shot, Moshe's question was well taken, so to speak. Good point. And then God directs him, gives him three signs. Three signs. One is not a reference. It's also interesting. Because when you're establishing yourself on the basis of miracles, there's something lacking in one. Because that itself, I think, would give us a bit of a clue, an opening in terms of understanding the Rambam's position as to why Sinai is necessary. Miracles have a value, but you have to calculate the value of the miracle in terms of the effect. In terms of the effect, that is, a person in a certain situation will, provided that the miracle is authentic, convincing, will operate up to a certain point on the basis of the miracle. It does have an effect, but it doesn't produce the kind of lasting effect that's necessary. You see that the Jews didn't accept the Torah on the basis of miracles, but they did follow Moshe Rabbeinu. Bear in mind also that they were in a situation of inflation, and they wanted to get out of that situation. And to accord him the proper authority and capability of being a leader, so the miracles had that effect. But when it comes to Torah, it's more than just that. It's more than just accepting the Torah or agreeing to follow the Torah. It's having a certain conviction, an absolute conviction that the Torah is empty. And here is where the Rambam says that the miracle is not 100%. It does not satisfy the mind completely. Because there's always room for doubt. Because I think that would explain why, even in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, that God gave him three. Because that's also a factor. It shows you there's a certain doubt. If there was no doubt, if the miracle was absolutely convincing, so why would God have to give him more than one? Well, it's just a waste. It's just duplication. But that, I think, would fit in with the Rambam's idea. That a person always has questions. It's true. It's true that it's hard to explain it. I can't explain how this could happen, how the staff could turn into a snake. But the fact that the person can't explain it and the fact that it sort of leads you in a certain direction is not absolutely convincing. Therefore, the more, and you see with regard to Mitzrayim too, you had 10 makos. The quantitative factor is an important element in the establishing the veracity of miracles, because each one in and of itself is true, but there's a certain element in the mind that maybe it's a coincidence, maybe, because it's an indirect phenomenon. You're making a certain deduction. You're filling in a certain blind spot, and of course, when you fill it in, it makes sense to assume that what this person is saying is true, that it's from God. But you're not absolutely convinced because you don't really see it yourself. The point being made that we see that the Egyptians, quote unquote, duplicated some of the osos, some of the makos. Now, what does that mean? Did they also have the power to change nature? No. The Mepharshim learned that they were acting with magic. It was magic, which only creates an appearance, but it's not what Moshe was doing. What Moshe was doing was a real Shina Hatava, a real change. Nevertheless, the fact that they could do so was sufficient to enable, to assist Pharaoh in denying the truth. Even though, if you compare the two, you would see the difference between what Moshe did and what the magicians did. Therefore, it shows you that a miracle lends itself to a certain deniability. A rational individual would come to a certain conclusion, but not everybody's rational. The way it's structured, it leaves a little bit of room for doubt. It's not absolutely convincing. To make it clear, again, getting back to the point that Moshe Rabbeinu came to the Jews with three signs, not just one, that indicates that the miracle in and of itself is not that convincing, that it doesn't leave any room for that. And the fact that you have a quantitative factor, the fact that it can be duplicated, and also in different realms. One is with regard to the staff, one is with regard to the skin, and one is with regard to water. And each one is like a different aspect of reality that adds to the idea that there is some being who has this kind of control over the forces of nature. Bear in mind also that the main reason for following Moshe Rabbeinu was the person himself. He's an individual that's a Navi, that the perfected individual with tremendous wisdom, and not from Charleston. He just, for whatever reason, we can't account, but somehow or other it's connected to some kind of miraculous phenomenon. The miraculous phenomena go together with the character of the individual. And it's important that a person should have this in mind, not to be carried or swept off their feet by an appearance of something. No matter how convincing it may seem at the moment, let's see, you don't know. A lot of strange things happen. According to the Rambam, miracles were needed to establish the veracity of a Navi, and basically there's only one case where in the Torah, according to the Rambam, where a Navi establishes credentials to the miracle. Yeah, the only case really is Moshe Rabbeinu, because the Avos did not engage in this kind of thing. The Avos never operated the miracle. The Avos operated through Bacha. They taught mankind about the falsity of Avodah Zarah, and they directed them towards the truth, Allah Baruch Hu, and the correct way to serve God. But they did not resort to any kinds of supernatural phenomena to back up their case. That reinforces the point. That's the essence, that Yadus does not maintain that people ought to be brought around to the truth because of the supernatural, by the power of the ideas, the logic, using their mind. That's the methodology that they use. And God performed miracles for them, but God did not perform miracles for them in that context. The only time, according to the Rambam, that miracles served as role was Moshe Rabbeinu. Because after the Torah was given, there were many Nevi'im. But the reason why we have Nevi'im is because of a parish in the Torah. That's a mitzvah, that God, in his providential relationship with the Jewish people, will provide Nevi'im, will provide prophets, to guide the people, to chastise the people, to instruct them from time to time. And there's a mitzvah of the Torah to listen to the word of the Navi. That's Ivrei Hashem. And the Navi went, but that has to be a legitimate, authentic Navi, and the manner in which he's established as a Navi is dictated by the Torah. Who is a legitimate Navi? Who's not a legitimate Navi? And according to the Rambam, he does not establish legitimacy through miracles. And the reason why, he just has to conform to the requirements of the Torah. He's defined as a Navi in accordance with the Torah. Once he has that definition, whatever he says in the name of Hashem, if it's a command, if God is commanding us at a certain point in history to do something, then we're obligated to accept it as a Dvar Hashem, and upon pain of death. And anyone that rebels against the word of a Navi, according to the Rambam, we do not ask a prospective Navi, somebody who comes forth and claims that he has a Navua. We don't ask him to perform miracles. We do ask him, as part of the test of his credentials, to predict future events. He has to, the Rambam talks about this in his Akdama to the Purim HaMashiach, and in other places, but that's the main place where he discusses it. And it has to be proven to be true in every detail. It's not a vague general thing, but it's got to be specific. It's got to be something which is in the future, which you really, there's no way that you can know. And it's got to be specific and correct and with regard to every detail. And if he is wrong in his predictions, or even in a particular, then he's defined as a Navi Sheker and he's put to death. This is a very, very serious type of phenomenon. Because you can't corrupt the whole institution of a Navi. However, according to the Rambam, he's never asked. He passes that test, he's not asked, well, to perform a miracle. Because the reason why we believe him is not because of miracles. We believe him because there's a parasha of the Torah, a command to follow the words of the Navi. And if there was no such parasha, if there was no mitzvah, then we wouldn't accept anybody. We would just live in accordance with the Torah. And if somebody came along and claimed that he had special powers and special messages and did miracles, we would ignore it. Because there's no way we live in accordance with the Torah. And if the Torah did not contain a parasha about the Navi, so then we would say we're not interested in the book. We already have God's will. God has revealed his will for us. This is the Torah. People don't have that idea clearly, because you see, a lot of you here today, there's always cases of somebody having special powers and making predictions and all these different types of things. And there's this, when somebody says over some idea, some explanation, the name of some rebbe, whatever, and you challenge it, you question on logical grounds, and there's a discussion, and then the other person can't defend it logically. So then they have recourse, oh, you know, you talk with this person, there's a Baal Mofes, you perform signs, and then so on and so forth, to try and bolster the individual's authority. As if to say that if that is the case, first of all, the answer is that if the person has performed any types of miracles, which means supernatural phenomena, it should be done publicly.
the fact that there's a rumor about it, and then there's no verification, renders it absolutely meaningless. Secondly, it wouldn't make any difference. If an individual were to come here today with some kind of an idea that we should do this or we should do that, or an explanation of Torah, some concept, and it didn't make sense, it was not logical, and any person who knew Torah would be able to refute it. And then this person would try to establish the credibility through performing some kinds of signs and wonders. It would not add one iota. If something is false, it's false. And the fact that the person would do something which he couldn't explain, which would appear to be supernatural, would not in any way, shape, or form affect our behavior. For anybody to be influenced along those lines, that would be absolute true in the Torah. That's exactly what the Ramana is saying. After Maamar Har Sinai, we cannot be affected, we cannot be influenced in any way, shape, or form by miracles or anything that would be appearing to us as miracles. Bear that in mind. We reject the Jesus, we reject Christianity, whatever the thing was, whatever they claim was, whether Jesus actually held the idea of Christianity, or that was what they made it up later and projected it back on him. It's irrelevant. If somebody were to come to us and say that we have to accept these ideas, the Christian ideas, and of course we reject it. And then that individual was to perform miracles, meaning changes in the order of things that we could not account for in a natural way. So what would you say? Oh well, if that's the case, we have to follow this. Yeah. Well, this would be a test. But there's the possibility that such a thing would occur. The Rambam discusses it. I don't know that it ever happened in history. I know that false religions have developed in history. And you see this type of a way of thinking that affects this even down to this day among Jews. That you can't argue with him because he's known to have performed oses or signs or miracles or whatever. He has special powers. But the Jews today don't reject that notion that they can attribute special powers to people. I've repeated that many times. There is no such thing. But there is that sense that if a person has those powers, then somehow it gives credibility to his ideas. That's completely false, if I'm going to be honest. I don't know of a case in history where somebody tried to impose false ideas to the performance of miracles, other than that the rumor circulated that this person has the ability to do it. That's rumors. But in terms of really performing it in a public way, that would be the case that the Rambam talks about. If the Navi Sheker were to come and to try and dissuade us from keeping the Torah, and he would say, what should we listen to you? We have the Torah from God. And he would say, no, this is God's will. And we would say, well, how do we know? Give us a sign. And he would perform the most devastatingly impressive miracle. Bigger than Kriya Shamsim, bigger than... The Rambam talks about this. So what would you do? We would absolutely reject it. Because we're not interested in miracles. We don't believe in the Torah because of miracles. So that we're going to now compare the miracles you perform to the miracles that Moshe performed, and then we'll decide who to listen to. That's exactly what the Ramban is saying. One of the reasons that the Torah is established on something which is beyond a miracle, an ordinary miracle, is to make it, to establish its veracity in an absolute way, intellectually speaking. You know that it's the truth. If you know that it's the truth, then there can't be change. And therefore, anybody that would come to you with something which contradicts the Torah has to be false. Because you've seen with your own eyes that the Torah is true. It would be the same situation would be when witnesses come and report something to you. You didn't see the event yourself. So then you're going to, you have to follow what they say, basically. You have no choice. Assuming that they're credible, assuming that they have a lot of witnesses. But if you were there and you witnessed the event itself, like the space shuttle, like what? All right, let's assume that that it really crashed. But they're trying to keep it a secret. They didn't have television, and if they're trying to keep it a secret, so they're going to tell the people that it took off and they're trying to wait to space and whatever, and they'll work out the details later. That's the story. So all there's a conspiracy now of all the witnesses that were there are going to make up that story. So now, if you weren't there, and all the people that report, that's the report, so then you'd have no choice. You have to go along with that. But let's say you were there. You were there, and you started crashing into the sea, with your own eyes. And now you have hundreds and thousands of witnesses are saying, is there any way that you would give any credence to what they're saying? Because the only time you give credence to the report of a witness is because you yourself do not have any knowledge, any independent knowledge of it. So then you have to go with a certain level of acceptance. And then you decide, well, are they credible? Should I believe them? Shouldn't I believe them? Whatever the case is. If it turns out that it's credible, then you'll accept it. But you'll never do so in a situation which is counter to what you yourself know to be true, unless you just give up the power of your mind. What I'm saying is that our relationship to Torah, that the Torah comes to us from God, and it's the will of God that we keep the Torah, is based on our knowledge. It's based on our knowledge, and there's no way that anybody can convince us otherwise, no matter what miracles he performs. It would be if you were at Sinai. If you were at Sinai yourself, and you heard this from God, God commanded you to keep the Torah. So now you know firsthand that this is the will of God. So 5 years later, if an individual were to come to you and tell you that God communicated to him that you shouldn't keep the Torah, would you believe that person? Would you believe that person? You couldn't believe that person because your own knowledge tells you that God wants you to keep the Torah. You were there. You heard directly from God. So you wouldn't believe it. Now, let's say you perform all kinds of miracles. Would that increase your belief in what he's saying? How would it increase your belief? What difference does it make? It's an impossibility. What this person is telling you is something which your own knowledge tells you is an impossibility. So therefore, you wouldn't believe it. You say that it's impossible. So what you're telling me is impossible. And they say, well, what about the miracle? How is that? Oh, no, I don't know how to come to that. That's what you say. So that you would not be able to explain the miracle. There the Rambam says, the only explanation would be God's testing. If indeed it is a miracle, which can't be explained in terms of any kind of human power, and would have to be subject to something beyond, so then God's testing me, the test. And that's exactly how you look at it. But it's impossible that what this person is saying is true, because I heard directly from God. And so the next question is, what is it about Sinai that differentiates it from all the other miracles? Any possible miracle that a person could love. And the surface Sinai also seems to be miraculous phenomenon. The description of the mountain, that the mountain was consumed in a fire that went all the way up to the heavens, and then thick clouds and smoke was enveloped in thick clouds and smoke. All these things seem to be miraculous phenomena. The sound of the shofar, the tremendous sound. What seems to differentiate it is that above and beyond that, this was all the context for a voice from heaven. A voice from heaven is communication. There is a supreme being who actually now has manifested himself through the directions. He's commanding us in mitzvot and ideas. A being of supreme intelligence who is directing, is addressing himself to us. That's the step beyond the miracle. Because the miracle is just a strange phenomenon which we can't explain. And it points in a certain direction, but it leaves a certain room for doubt because it doesn't answer the question. It's not direct. It's sort of you come to a place and you see what looks to be a design. You're not sure. Here's that one. Some kind of an excavation, or you know, like you come to this place in the middle of the forest, and it appears that there's a design, that there's an artist over here. But you can't explain how this came about, you can't explain how that, you're not absolutely convinced. But then you come into you discover a secret room, and you see this individual, and you see he's involved in painting, and those paintings correspond exactly to what you saw. Now it's been confirmed directly. Beforehand, it could be this, it could be that, you're not really sure, it's not absolute. And that's the same idea we do. We have to go by the account of the Torah. This is what the Torah says. That is to say that the entire Jewish nation was gathered, and they heard a voice, and they were... We can't get into the issue of how do you know that this voice was from heaven? Maybe it was just a loud voice. We can't get into that issue because the entire nation, the group that was gathered there, was convinced that it came from God. They say that openly. In fact, appeal to Moshe that they really couldn't take anymore. There's 2,000 of them. So that's something that you can't entertain any other possibility. You have to go by your sense, by your sense of things. You can't deny. If you deny your own senses, then how do you know you saw anything? The important thing is that they saw something which convinced them that this was from heaven. That's the basis of the whole thing. What they witnessed then was that there is a being beyond this universe, and that being is a being of Chachma, and then communicates with us, has complete control over the forces of nature. You see? In other words, now it was associating the cause or the source of the miraculous phenomena together with the being, with God. In the other cases, you had miraculous phenomena. So therefore, you have to make the deduction of what the source is. These were phenomena that couldn't be duplicated by any person. If they could be duplicated, they have no value. These were phenomena that could not be duplicated. So now you see phenomena that you can't account for. So either you could just negate it and say, well, I just can't explain it. Or you could say, like Moshe is saying, this is a demonstration of the power of these supreme beings who brought the entire system into existence. But they didn't see that themselves. That's a deduction. And since it's a deduction, it leaves a certain amount of room for that, the deduction. But in this situation, you have the miraculous phenomena and the cause addressing you at the same time, so now you see clearly that where it comes from. Here's the phenomena, and here's the being who's responsible for this phenomena, talking to you and telling you that this is the reality of the situation. I am the Lord your God. I'm the one who took you out of Egypt. I'm the one who's responsible for all the phenomena that's supernatural, that's beyond nature. There, you're seeing phenomena in conjunction with these sources. He's communicating with you. That's so you're not making a deduction of it. Bear in mind that it's a very important discernment. In all of the signs that Moshe performed, they all pointed in the direction of a supernatural being. So you can ask the question, why? Well, maybe Moshe is a powerful guy. Why should I bring it up? Now, Moshe has the ability to do it. That never came up. Paro, who rejected the message, didn't deify Moshe. But the mind rules that out. Any intelligent person has to rule out the idea that a human being can perform miracles. That's absolutely absurd. The reason being is because everything that exists that we can comprehend, that we're aware of, is a part of the system. It comes into being as a result of the product. Every animal is a product. Every individual is a product. So anything that exists only because of the system and is a product of the system only has the capabilities that it can doubt by virtue of what the system provides you with. And therefore you wouldn't expect to find the dog that could fly. And if a person looks for a Christian idea, you say that's absolutely insane. So where's this dog going to get the dog is not the author of its own abilities, it's just a product. It came into being because something else designed it. The absurdity is that when it comes to a man, which is no different, it comes to being as a byproduct of the system. So therefore he's been designed by something beyond himself, unless you want to maintain the eternity of the universe. Which of course, if that's the case, he certainly doesn't have any, there's no such thing as supernatural power. Therefore, it's absurd to say that that man can perform anything outside of the natural powers that he's endowed with. So man has intellectual powers, he has some physical powers, whatever the case may be, but none of these things point to any capability of being above nature. You can't be above nature. By definition, you're a product of nature. You are nature. How can you have man to paint such an idea of being above nature? So where is it that people come up with these ideas of people having supernatural powers? That's because of human egotism. It's this Superman phenomenon. Because people fantasize about such a thing. If there wasn't this human ego and this tremendous need to feel this domination over the system, then nobody would have such a crazy idea. So the only people that maintain such a thing, that a human being who's just a natural, is a product of a system and is endowed with natural abilities, can have anything other than natural abilities is an absurdity. And that's why you reject the idea that Moshe is doing this thing. He's a human being just like you. So therefore, it must be that how can it change? How can the natural processes be changed? This is the order of the universe. How can the order of the universe be changed? Well, if you maintain that the universe is eternal and the way things are the way they have to be because that's the way they are, that's the way they have to be. That's the eternity of the universe, then you can't have a change. Because by definition, that's the reason why a thing is the way it is because it has to be that way. But if you maintain that the universe has been created, that it has a creator, that the way it is, you find it now, is not because it has to be that way, because there's a being who wills that it should be this way, and he has absolute control over all of the different forces within the universe, so that being can bring about a change. That's what the whole point of the miracle. The point of the miracle was to establish that the natural order of things, the way things are, and find it is not because it has to be that way. It's because the Creator wills that it should be that way. And he has the ability to make a change. That's the concept. And that's what a miracle points to. Is how do you explain this? Now, you could say that no, that we're learning something new about the universe. You could say it's not a miracle, it's just something that has to occur. But we don't, until now, we've never seen it, but we don't know everything. We don't know how the universe is functioning, so how do we know that the universe at a certain point in time, that the waters are not going to spill? That's something which you, that's the only argument you can raise. There, the answer is that if that is the case, that it's just something which is completely unforeseen, completely unknown, but it's natural, it's not supernatural, then the question arises, how did Moshe Rabbeinu know exactly when it was that day? That's the role of the Navi. If that were the case, then Moshe Rabbeinu is no different than anybody else. And yet, how did he know that this event would occur in conjunction with the saving of the Jewish people? And then as soon as they came out, the waters would come back and destroy the Egyptians. That you see that it's functioning over here in accordance with a different set of causations, which it has to do with the will of the Supreme Being. But the main way that we know it is only through Moshe Rabbeinu. By the way, that's basically the rationalization. One of the rationalizations that power uses is that these things happen once there's a law being done, and there was a motto. When they wanted to rationalize the night, they would say, well, so we are not once in 100 years these things happen. But that was denial, because if that is the case, how could it be that it was precisely connected to a specific event with regard to the Jews and that Moshe Rabbeinu predicted? The difference, a person can easily see the difference between magic, and a miracle. And it's not because you ask the magician and the magician will tell you that it's sleight of hand. It's simply that every magician, you can tell when there's a magic show. Because there's a certain distance that you have to maintain. You get a team of scientists. Get a team of scientists to examine any one of the illusions that are performed or the best magic tricks. A team of scientists may have three actors. To see, to be behind the curtain, to you give them free access, let any illusionist or magician have a group of other magicians have completely free access. You cannot maintain any kind of control. Every magician maintains a certain type of control over the environment that he's in. Keeps the audience at a distance, and so therefore the curtain goes around, and as soon as it comes up, it's a lion, and the girl is gone. So to you, you can't. But there's a trick. So if you insisted on these conditions, then no magic could exist. They never would allow it. They never would allow it. So the same thing with Paro. Why did God give Moshe Rabbeinu a sign which could be duplicated? You read the Parsha, you see, Balakayim. They did this with their secret devices and in a magical kind of a way to create a certain appearance. And then his snake swallowed their snake. So that if Paro really wanted to, if he called in the magician because of a scientific interest in establishing whether they could duplicate it, he would have discovered that it's just magic. But the reason why it's what Red Pasha said is that he hardened his heart. Below Shadamah, he hardened his heart. Why did he have to harden his heart? If he had refuted Moshe, he's by virtue of what his magicians had done, so why did he have to harden his heart? The answer is because he had to harden his heart, because if he would have been completely honest, he would have seen that what they were doing was not the same thing that Moshe Rabbeinu was doing. And I maintain that that's the case, that every time Moshe Rabbeinu did a sign, it was something that was in the open, that there was no secrecy to it, there was no magic associated with it, as opposed to all the magic that we know throughout history is exactly that, magic. And the Rambam, in Yisori HaTorah, at the end of Shemiva Perachimim. Yisichach imamad ha-Navi yiyasa otos umosim gedolim. He's saying after Sinai. After the foundation of our belief is not because of miracles, it's because we saw it on our eyes. And therefore, if a Navi were to arise and perform signs and great signs and wonders, and he sought to refute the Nevuah of Moshe, he wouldn't listen to him. And we know of a certainty that those miracles, those signs are belot v'kishachon, that they're done with some type of a sorcery or magic. Well, Tisha Nevuah Moshe Rabbeinu ain't al pi ha'osos, because the Nevuah Moshe Rabbeinu is not based on signs. Tidei shenarach osos zeh li'osos zeh, so that we would weigh, we would compare these signs to those signs. Ela v'yengenu re'inuha, but we saw it with our own eyes, Ubiyazenu Shamanua. And we heard it with our ears, Kamosha Shamahu, just like Moshe heard. Palamaha Davadana, what is this analogous to? The Egan Shaidu Adam of Davashiraviyana. It's the same thing as two witnesses would testify to a person about something which he himself witnessed with his own eyes. She'eno Kamosha Ra. And they would testify that it didn't happen the way he saw it. She'eno shameyalan. He wouldn't listen to them. Ela yodeya b'vadai she'hen yedei sheka. He would know for a certainty that they are false witnesses. Lefidach amar Torah, therefore the Torah says, she'imba o'tziyam o'feis, that if the sign and wonder actually does come true, this person does perform the sign and wonder, lo sishma, o divrei hanavi yahu, that you shouldn't listen to the words of this Navi. Because this person is coming at you with a sign and a wonder, to negate that which you saw with your own eyes. Behold, the Einanu Ma'amin of the Mofes, and since we don't believe in the wonder, in the miracle, Elam Ve'am Mitzvah, if you want a Moshe, but we only believe in the Navi because of the Mitzvah. Moshe commanded us that part of Torah, that in the future, if the Navi should come, you should follow him. How can we operate on the basis of this sign and wonder to repeat that which we know to be true because we've seen it with our own eyes? The Rambam in the Atama to the Buddha on the side. That's the same point. He's talking about a prophet who commands us to do something which is contrary to the Torah. He should not even attempt to verify his claim to prophecy. This is why he's speaking in the name of the Avodah Zarah, that God wants us to worship a certain idol or whatever, something like that. He should not even attempt to verify his claim to prophecy. And we should not ask him to perform a sign. Even if he did perform amazing signs and wonders as proof of his prophetic powers, he still must be strangled. We should pay no attention to his signs, because the reason these miracles came about is, quote, that Hashem is testing you. So it's supposed to be in the Devarim. Parsha in the Devarim, the Yigim of the Devarim. So you have to give up a Navi, a Cholim Cholom, a Nasim, a Rafa Osim Osim. And he's talking about it, that a Navi should arise and give you a sign or a wonder. And the predict a certain sign, and then the sign will come true. The Mosul. The Shigib Rebecha Lema, concerning which he said to you, Neocha Achle Elohim Acherim, Ashella Yudatam Ben Azim. And his message was, had to do with idolatry. Well, Sishma El Dubne Anavi Aho, do not listen. So this Navi Aho, Cholay Machalam Hoki, Menasa Rashem Lokechem Eskam. Because God is testing you, Lazas, Aishchem Ohavim, Okay, Rashem Lokechem, Machalavachem, Machalavachem. That this would be a test from God to see whether you love God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, which means to say whether the foundation of your amunah and the veracity of the Torah is absolute. The way the Rambam explains it in the Hakdamas of the Pirush HaMishnayos, would seem to leave open the possibility that such a phenomenon could actually occur. And of course, all the other religions try to have reference to some miracle that this one did or the other one did. And of course, they don't really have anything because they can't bring any proof. Because there's no case in history where anybody did a public miracle which convinced the entire people that what they were witnessing was a miracle. All the miraculous stories attributed to Jesus or Muhammad, whatever it is rumors. It was never publicly verified. He ain't in the cave, he walked on water, it was never, you don't have anybody testifying that they saw it. So this has never really occurred. But even if it were, the underlying premise somehow is that if they could convince you that he did these things, then you'd have to follow him is absolutely absurd. Even if it was confirmed that he did this, that he flew around the world and came back and landed on his feet, it would be meaningless, it would have no effect whatsoever. But then he left the question about how could it be? If it would be something that you have to assume is a miracle, like you have to rule out magic. I believe that that's what the Torah is saying. That if, of course, first you would check and you try and get all the magicians together to show that it can't be. But even if you couldn't do that, and even if the magicians did not attribute to any kind of magic, it would be meaningless, because we would say it's just. So the idea that there could be something which we would have to view as miraculous phenomenon associated with the attempt of somebody to dissuade us from Torah is something that could arise in the framework of a test. I don't know of any case where it's actually held, but that's the Torah saying, and that's what the Rambam is saying. This is why the Torah was established on a foundation which is not miracle. Which is direct, as direct as is possible for the human mind, for the human being, to come in contact with the source. A direct confrontation with the Kaddish Baruch. That's what Sinai is really about. Once that's the case, that your knowledge of Torah is direct, it's not based upon anything extraneous, but then you're in the situation now of someone who's heard from the commander himself, so to speak. And the other people are testifying that the commander gave different orders. Yeah, as I said, normally if you can hear from the commander, so you have no choice. You have to listen to those who claim to be witnesses. But when you heard the commander yourself, you were there when he issued the orders, And he said, don't attack, so nobody can convince you otherwise. I want to make it clear that the objective of Mamad Har Sinai is two specific objectives. Of course, they're connected with each other. And one is to reveal the existence of God. Not just the existence of God, but the fact that the Torah is from the first level, to affirm the divine source of the Torah. Now, something which is intricately connected to that is the phenomenon of Moshe Rabbeinu. It is to say that God did not reveal the entire Torah at Sinai. He just revealed a part of it, the Aseret HaDibros. And we have to go into that and make a study as to why, what's so unique about those 10 ideas, the 10 Dibros, which constitute more mitzvahs. These are the major foundations, major headings, whatever you want to say. It's an extremely significant portion of the Torah that's contained in the Aseret HaDibros. But it's not the entire Torah, as we all know. So therefore, what was also essential was that the source of Torah is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the Torah is going to be transmitted to us via certain individuals. First and foremost is Moshe Rabbeinu. So therefore, the authenticity of Moshe Rabbeinu has to be established, because everything that's going to be revealed to us is going to come out through Moshe Rabbeinu. So therefore, the ultimate authenticity of the Nevuah, of Moshe Rabbeinu, was also established at Sinai, and that is stated clearly in the pasuk. It's a very crucial pasuk, which says, "Nei anochi bo elecha bi'afa anan." This is the pasuk in which God tells Moshe the manner of the revelation. I'm going to come to you in the thickness of the cloud. Ba'avro yishma ha'am b'davi yimach, in order that the people will hear when I speak to you. And also implies that it's not the only idea, but it's an integral component. Also in you will they believe forever. Now, there's a number of ideas over here, but the essential ones are the people will hear. The people will have first-hand knowledge which will come about through their senses, through the mechanism of their senses, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the Creator addresses mankind. And that's the first idea. So therefore we know that there is a Creator, first and foremost, that there is a Creator. We know that the Creator is not removed, is not aloof from the creation. Or many, many forms of the Creator are removed by the universe. God is aware of what goes on in the universe, that we're quite, so to speak, concerned about how people should live their lives, and perhaps more significantly, the idea of prophecy, that God communicates in a manner which is knowable to us. Those are some of the ideas. That's Torah. The Torah is the national life. But there's another significant aspect, and that is how does God transmit his ideas to us? That's the mechanism of the ruach, the ruach, and not everybody's a nabi. So this is to authenticate the nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's not only with regard to the written law, it's to authenticate Moshe Rabbeinu with regard to everything and every aspect of the revelation, which of course includes the oral law as well. And la'olam means not just Moshe, but all those who come after Moshe. That Moshe is going to establish a system. The Balei HaMasorot, those who are authorized to transmit the Masorot. The system that Moshe Rabbeinu establishes, because you have to have such a system. You see why these things are necessary and one idea follows from the other. If you accept the fact that the written law, so to speak, the Torah of God, is from God, then you're obligated to accept the authenticity of the so-called Torah Kabbalah, of the oral law. Because it's impossible to decipher. It's impossible to understand the meaning of the flourish of the cloud without recourse to the system of interpretation, all of the ideas, all the explanations, what this stands for, what this means, and what is the shark on the other side, exactly. What is the stone? None of the laws in the Torah are spelled out with any type of specificity. There's no way that you could possibly figure out the will of a Kaddish law. You can never figure out the system. You can never figure out the mitzvah. So it is clear that one idea follows from another. That if we assume, if we're convinced that at Sinai God was communicating to man, to the Jewish people, of course, and ultimately to mankind, the system by which he wants people to live, and it's something which is capable of being understood and implemented, then there's got to be a body of interpretation, a correct body of interpretation, because the Torah Sheva Sot by itself, in and of itself, is impossible to figure out. It's written in such a way that nobody can possibly figure out, even in a general sense, what it's referring to. It's not a self-contained unit, as opposed to sometimes an author writes a book. Some people write more specifically, some people write more clearly, some people write less clearly, but if a person has any clarity whatsoever, you more or less can figure out what he's saying. You can say, well, I got the general idea, I don't know exactly every aspect, but I got 80%. That's true, you need an editorial in the paper. At least you know what the person is saying, you may not agree with the person. But you read the Torah, and then that's why you see that all of the various sects, whether they're in Judaism or they're outside of Judaism, Christian sects, that limit themselves, essentially they're all united in one thing, the rejection of the Torah Shel Tzad, the rejection of the Oral Law. If you limit yourself just to the Torah Shel Tzad, just to the written law, then there's virtually an infinite amount of possibilities. You can do it any way you want. And you have absolutely no way of knowing what you're talking about, whether what you're saying has any validity whatsoever. So you're completely lost, and therefore there's no objective has been achieved. The objective that the God has communicated his will to mankind has not been achieved through solely through the means of this law. So that's why you have to assume that at the same time, God communicated the proper way to understand. And that, of course, we have. We go back from generation to generation, those very same sources that communicated the written law to us have communicated the oral law to us. I've gone a little bit further than the question. The question primarily was addressed to the idea of Moshe Rabbeinu, that the ultimate validation of the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu, and more than that, that Moshe Rabbeinu is the selected instrument, not in this, not necessarily just in this case or in the other case, not necessarily when we do that in twice, but that in all cases, that Moshe Rabbeinu has been designated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be the spokesman. This is what God called Moshe in Mitzrayim, that don't see a cross of Mitzrayim, Havdun es Olam Ha'arzeh. Alright, now the question is that if that is the case, that it was the will of God that the people should have direct knowledge of the fact that the Torah comes from God, that Moshe is designated the spokesman. So, if that is the case, so what about all the future generations? Well, that's an argument. So that you could say, so that's good, that's for the generation that actually witnessed it. And many people say, had we been there, had we witnessed such a thing, as described by the Torah. Then, of course, we would draw the proper conclusion. This would remove all doubts from our hearts. And our belief would be complete. Now, if that is the will of God, that our belief in the Torah should be based upon this type of a knowledge, so what about all these generations? What is the basis for the belief of the generations that were not present at Sinai? That's the question. Well, in the Gemara, the Torah commands us not to forget what we saw. that this event was orchestrated and brought about in such a way that it would be not limited, it wouldn't be limited just to those particular people of choice, but it would provide the basis for all mankind throughout all of history to be able to ascertain that the event occurred. This idea is mentioned in the verse. And that makes a lot of sense. But it's to say that God's return, of course, was for that particular generation, but what good would it do if it was limited just to that generation? And the Pope himself says, V'dam b'chol yaminim l'olam, that there believes in you l'olam. So therefore, it's necessary to assume that God did it in such a way that we would have knowledge of it, that all future generations would be able to know that this event actually occurred. And once they know that this event actually occurred, so then they'd be in the same position as those who actually witnessed it. They would be in that position through their knowledge. Now this idea is stated in the vault. Okay, let's take a look at the farm. Look at the farm. Third knowledge. Test. After it mentions that you should guard the Torah, Yichach Maskam, Uminaskam, Uyeni Ha'amim, this is your chachma, your discernment, in the eyes of the nation. They'll hear these statutes, they'll hear about these laws, and they'll say, Rakam Chacham Benavon, Azar Azar Lazar. Then you get a test, Rakim Shana Lacha, but guard yourself, Yishmor Nafshka Ma'od, and guard your soul very much, Ten Tishkach Hashem Dvarim, Asher Rohu Enecha. Lest you forget the matters that your eyes saw, Ufan Yosuru Mubavka, or lest you remove them, you allow them to be removed from your heart. You lose touch. It's more than just forgetting. It's losing touch with the ideas that lead you to this conclusion. You have to teach them to your children, and your children's children. The day that you stood before the Lord your God in Torah, then more I go shame alive, and God said to me, Hakel Yesoham. Gather unto me the people, Vashviyim Estavai, and I'll let them hear my words, Ashayomudun, that they should learn the year Osi, Kalayanim, and so forth. Then it goes on to describe the event. And the day, and God spoke to you, Mitzotha Eish, from the midst of the fire. Then he told you his covenant, and so forth. One second. The idea that the Jews are obligated to study this aspect of history, and that if you study history properly, you will be able to establish beyond a doubt that this event actually occurred, is mentioned over here in the book. These are the psukim. Take a look at Dalad Lamed Beis. Kisha'almo Yemen Rishonim asked, inquire about the early days, the beginning. That's a reference to studying the history. Ashahayu Lepanecha, the days that existed before you came into being, studying history. Go back all the way, from the very beginning of time. And from one end of the heavens to the other end. So, check the history of the entire world and see whether this phenomenon ever occurred. Haniya, Kadamra Gadalazet, has this great thing ever occurred? Oh, Hanishma Kamal. Or has anything been heard like it? So compare what we're studying over here and see whether anything of a similar nature ever occurred in the result. Hashoma Am Kol Elokim. Here's the key thing. Has a nation ever heard the voice of God? Mitzaber Mitzotha Eish, speaking from the midst of the fire. Kasher, has a nation ever study history of a nation and see whether you have such a phenomenon, whether such an event exists in the history of any other nation. Oh, and you say, Elohim Lavar, Lakaka, Kod, Jor, Mishael, God. Or whether this is a reference to the Tzias Mitzrayim. But this concludes on Lamed Hei, Akta HaReisa LaGar, You have seen to know Hashem Hu Elokim Ein Ovada. This is saying that the foundation of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is based upon that, based upon knowledge. You have been shown. You have been shown to know. You have been enabled to have a visual experience which will give you the appropriate type of idea, of knowledge. And then Allah says, Yadaka Yom Vashivosa Lavacha, you should know this day and incorporate it into your heart, that Hashem Hu Elokim, Vashemayim Mal, the Lord is talking, saying no. As a result of everything that occurred to the Jewish people, the conclusion, the result of this is that we are obligated not to have some kind of a faith as the world understands it. This is a tremendous mistake that many Jews make this mistake because of assimilation. And because every religion is based upon this thing called faith, which for means, for all intents and purposes, that it's something you just believe in. There's no way you can prove it. There's no way you can know whether it occurred or not. It's faith. So, and that's elevated to a high level. That's considered a person of faith is considered to be a very exalted level, because even though he has no knowledge, he puts his faith in it. Which really, from a rational standpoint, to the contrary, makes no sense at all. If you hold that the essence of a person is really the talent of him, the divine element, the ability to think, the custom, the reason, so then that would be a serious criticism that in an area which is very vital, in any area, a person abandons wisdom and just follows emotion to guide him, that person would be lacking in terms of rationality to criticize. Certainly in the most significant of all areas, that his whole way of life is anchored in his religious beliefs, and this is something in which he abandons reason and follows a certain emotion that compels him. Or he follows a system that he was raised in, because he was raised that way. And he can't free his mind from that type of pressure to be able to think intelligently on that, on his subject. I've just been digressing a little bit over here, that people have a tremendous resistance towards the idea that the fundamentals of Yahadus can be established through verification. I hesitate to use the word proof only because proof has certain connotations, so that people who are resistant will try and bring criteria what constitutes a proof in accordance to the science and what's acceptable as a proof. So I just want to avoid that whole hassle, so to speak. Remember, the point over here is that in accordance with the way the entire world functions, in accordance with the criteria by which we establish that certain things took place in history, and no intelligent person would question them. If we could establish what the criteria are by which people will accept things, people are convinced that certain things occurred in terms of history. So what we're saying is that this event, the event of Torah Sinai, that God revealed the Torah to the Jewish people, is not something which we are expected to just believe in. But if this is what the Torah itself is saying, if we study the matter from the perspective of how we establish things in history, we'll be able to see that this is as firm, that this is as firm and as clear and convincing as any other thing that we accept to be true in history, to the extent that, well, many things, everybody agrees to certain things as historical knowledge. Historical knowledge essentially means, can we have knowledge about things that occurred that we ourselves didn't witness, the things that occurred outside of our own perception. That's really what the idea of history is. We weren't there. There's nobody living that witnessed the Revolutionary War. There's nobody that was around at the Civil War. There's nobody that has personal knowledge that George Washington was the first president. And many, many other things, once you start to think about it. Yet, I don't think any sane person questions that these things actually occur. It's just not a matter of faith. I don't think a person says, well, I have faith that there was a Revolutionary War. Essentially, all of the history that you've been taught. And I'm not talking about the interpretation. With regard to the fundamental facts of history. These are things that every intelligent person accepts as true on the basis of knowledge. We may not understand why. But that's what we want to really go into. That's the basis of the inquiry. What are the criteria by which we accept certain things as being indisputable? There's no question in our minds we accept them to be true. From that angle, this is the question as to whether Sinai occurred, as it is described in the Torah, is really a question, did a certain event occur in history at a certain point? It's a question of history. Another aside, the word emuna, in the realm of emuna shlema, the word emuna does not mean faith, as most people take it to mean. For example, we use the word amen. In your bracha, you say amen. And what does it mean, amen? That you affirm, that you ascertain, that you give your concurrence to something. The word lahamin, for example, is used by Yosef, uses this word when he's incarcerating the brothers. And he tells them to go home and bring back the other brother. V'ayamein divreichem ha'emesetchem. We will ascertain. In other words, we'll speak to the younger brother. He'll interrogate him. I'll make an investigation to see whether his story confirms your story. V'ayamein divreichem. So really, it means something which is ascertained and which is clear to you. It doesn't mean that you didn't believe in something without any basis in knowledge. It's something which is affirmed, which is clear. Yeah.
The Torah does not endorse blind faith. To the contrary, it's prohibited. To the contrary, the Ramban says it's a mitzvah. You're under the obligation of the mitzvah to know why it is that we base our lives on the Torah. Why we maintain that the Torah is from God. That's something that we have to have through the idea, through knowledge. And if you don't accept that, then first of all, why did God orchestrate it that way? I assume you believe that the Torah is true, or you have faith that the Torah is true, and then the Torah says that God appeared before the entire people in order that they should know. Then it says over there, in that very context, V'gam b'cha yaminu. And also in you, they will believe. What do you mean? So you see, it's not talking, the Aminu is not talking about a blind faith, because it's precisely through this knowledge. Through this knowledge, through what they've observed, that they will come to the Aminu Bacha. So Aminu means that it'll be clear to their mind, that they'll think it through, and they'll have the evidence that's necessary to arrive at a conclusion. That's Amunah. Now they're convinced, they have a conviction. A better word for emunah is conviction. That's a much, much better word. But a person is obligated to have a conviction. And this conviction, in terms of the fundamentals, should be based upon that part of the mind which operates with intelligence, with wisdom, with chokmah. So as I said, with regard to other things in history that are vital, you base your life on. You don't do so because you have a certain type of a blind faith. You're operating with a certain chain of ideas which make it very compelling. The problem, however, is, as I said, that we don't question. Nobody seriously questions that we're all belong to place. And all Most of the major events, and I'm talking just on a factual basis, there's a lot of controversy in history with regard to interpretation. That's something else. But when you're talking about interpretations, you're not talking about clearly demonstrable facts. And then there's tremendous people can speculate all they want. That's something else. But with regard to there's thousands and thousands of books on World War One, on World War Two, there's millions of books. Or from different perspectives and so forth. But every one of these books all are agreed on the basic fact that World War II took place, on the basis of World War II. Who fought against who? Who won the war? When did the war begin? And so on and so forth. The basic fact in history. Nobody questions that. All right, having said that, we're going to try to see, to apply the standards by which we determine that something occurred in history. We're going to try and establish what the criteria are. And once we establish what the criteria are, then we'll see whether they can be applied to what the Torah describes, to the event that's described in the Torah. That is, that an entire nation was gathered, and they saw the tremendous fire, and they heard his voice, and that this nation was absolutely convinced that the Creator was communicating with them. Now, in order to approach this, the question is, what is the criteria by which we accept things as being true in history? Historical knowledge. Now, in order to facilitate an understanding of that, we can merely put the question in a different way. Because there are, essentially, there are two different types of knowledge that we live with. Two different ways that we have of ascertaining things. One is direct, first-hand knowledge, and the other is second-hand knowledge. So, what do we mean by first-hand knowledge?
Fire.
Yeah, something which you yourself possess. You witnessed a fire, and you have first-hand knowledge of that fire. Or you performed an experiment, so you know that you know certain procedures. Now, let's ask ourselves, let's get a certain perspective. In terms of most of the knowledge that you live by, that you base your life upon, what percentage of it would you say is first-hand knowledge, and what percentage would you say is second-hand knowledge? Which is the greater? Yeah, the truth of the matter is, if you start to think about it this way, you'll see that there's very few things that you really know in a first-hand way. For example, who's the President of the United States? Of course, George Bush. But if I ask you, how do you know? Does anybody here have knowledge, first-hand knowledge? The answer is, well, you saw it on television? What do you know from a first-hand perspective? You haven't seen anything first-hand. You pictures on television, that's just television. How do you know that what you see is true? You see a picture of an individual in a White House at a podium and so forth, how do you know that that's true? That's not first-hand knowledge. Because you're trusting somebody else. Someone else has determined, has set up the prop, has created this picture. You're basing yourself on somebody else. How do you know that it's not an imposter? And today, we all have first-hand knowledge of that camcorder. Everybody knows that this is a thing. Everybody knows that they can dress an individual up. And everybody in there, right here, we can make a film. I could be posing as the president. You can duplicate the podium, President of the United States, President Mann, and so forth, and broadcast to the whole nation. You can all do that, and everybody can turn on their television and hear a press conference from President Mann. If you think about it, you'll realize that there's very, very few things in your life that you have any real first-hand knowledge about. You go to a doctor, you put yourself in his hands, you get on an operating table, how do you know? Yeah, how do you know that he's a doctor? And how do you know when you buy a product that it doesn't have poison in it? I would say, the more you think about it, there's very few things that you know in that way that you've witnessed personally. And that's basically it has nothing to do whether it happens happening now or whether it's happening in the past. That's what history is all about. History is essentially how do we ascertain what is true in terms of second-hand knowledge? Because when we're talking about history, we're talking about those things that happened in the past. We're talking about those things that we ourselves did not witness. So now the question is, and this is something which I'm not saying that it's irrational for people. It's rational for people to be clear, to have no doubt that George Bush is the president. I'm not suggesting that that we should start wondering. Or that the United States is a superpower, or that the world World War II occurred and so forth. However, these things, people function in an instinctive kind of a way with regard to these things. We have to really analyze it. So you ask the person, how do you know that World War II took place? They'll say, well, are you crazy? I mean, he's not going to... What's wrong with you? Of course you know it took place. But that's different than actually isolating what the factors are and making a formula out of it. Because in order to apply it to the scene, you have to have a formula. If you knew what the formula was, what is the formula by which an intelligent individual is bound to accept something as being true, then we could apply it to the phenomena. So let's ask ourselves the question. In terms of secondhand knowledge, what are the factors which determine whether we should accept somebody's report as being true or not being true? Some of the factors quickly. Whenever we receive a report from someone else as to something which we did not witness, we have to make a decision. Should we accept it as true or not? So basically, we accept it as true if we can eliminate all of the factors of distortion, of falsehood. We have to understand what would cause a certain report to be untrustworthy, to be lacking in trustworthiness. If we can determine what those factors are, then when somebody gives us a report, so we want to ascertain whether it actually is true or whether it's not true. So essentially what you're doing is you're going to test it. Now, a report from another individual would be suspect because of two possible factors. What are the two possible factors?
He's lying or didn't.
Yeah. Either he's lying, that's what we put, either he's lying, or he's not lying. But just because he's not lying doesn't, he can still be wrong because he can be making a mistake. So let's see, how do we proceed from there to try and eliminate those factors? For example, let's assume that he's not lying. We know that he's not lying. He's not a liar. For now, we've eliminated one of the factors that would cause us to question him. But the question is, maybe he's making a mistake. How do you eliminate the factor of mistake?
Something very simple.
Yeah. If the thing in question is something which is within the range of his knowledge and understanding. And that the more complex the thing is, the more questionable does he really understand. Perhaps he's making a mistake. If he's talking about something in abstract physics or whatever the case may be, of course, depends who the person is, his level of knowledge. But the simpler the thing is, for example, we're taking an ordinary individual of normal intelligence. And he reports, he comes from a town in the south, or so, or something, and he reports to the snow, which is unusual. So now let's say you've eliminated the possibility to the satisfaction of your mind that he's lying. So he has no reason to lie. So then, the question would be, only one maybe he's making a mistake. So what would the answer be? That any normal, intelligent person can determine if it's knowing or not. That's not something that requires any expertise. So if that's the kind of thing, if that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, so then you'd accept it as being true. If the kind of thing he's reporting about is something more complex, and it's not obvious to everyone, so then you can have more doubts about it. So therefore, the way to eliminate the factor of mistake is essentially through if the phenomenon in question are simply, clearly, easily within the range of this person's knowledge, the one who's reporting it, then you eliminate the possibility of mistake. Now the question is, how do you eliminate the possibility of lying? So then the answer is, so generally speaking, if you're dealing with a particular individual, so then it's a question of motivation. If the person has any motivation, so then he's suspicious.
the person has no motivation whatsoever, so then you can eliminate the possibility of life. Alright? Now, there's another way in which you can eliminate the possibility of lying. And you see, here again, people can argue and say, well, it's always possible. So when I use the word possibility, I mean really the probability. Because we're talking about establishing a truth over here. We're talking about knowing something. I'm talking, even when you know something, when you're convinced that it's true, there's nothing that you're convinced about that's true that you couldn't say it's impossible. You couldn't say such a thing. People think that they trust a certain individual. They trust them with their health. They trust them with their money. They may trust their life. And it's based upon solid evidence of performance and all of that. And then you're saying, I'm rationally convinced. It's impossible that this person would cheat on me. But technically speaking, you can't say it's impossible. It's possible. It's possible that they have been, and you just think anything is possible. When I'm saying impossible, I mean in terms of the subjective demand that a rational person would make. And that's rationality. That's what I mean when you think, that's a problem that people sometimes raise against it. Well, it's always possible to say something else. It's always possible to say that this happened. I don't mean that. I'm talking in terms, when I say that such a thing is impossible, it means to the satisfaction of the human requirement that an intelligent person does not, you can't, no, nobody has that capability of eliminating that idea. I mean, you can always say it's possible. We don't operate that way. It was in the same way that halakha based itself on a certain chazaka, that something was left in place and it's kosher and there's a system and so on and so forth. It's always possible that somebody came in and said, you need the kosher food, it's left in other things, and it looks identical. But it's impossible. You can always say it's possible. But you don't regard that as a valid possibility in terms of making the determination. That's what I'm trying to say. So there's another way, and what the other way is, that if something is confirmed by masses of people, by large groups of people, they all tell the same story. For example, if you were standing outside of Shea Stadium, and there was a game on, and you weren't inside, and somebody came out and told you that during the game, in the middle of the game, a lion jumped out of the stands and ran across the field and jumped up and caught a ball, and then it went into the dugout, something like that. So now, from the standpoint of sense perception, you say he's possessed, because that's something anybody could see. You could see a lie, you could see everything the person describes. But then you'd be suspect, because it sounds strange, and maybe he wants attention. He's making up a story. Now, let's say that every, 50,000 people. So what you do is, you interview every person that was there. And every person tells you the exact same story. So now, what would you do? Would you still be skeptical? Or you would say, well, first of all, what the person is telling you is possible, it's a little depends. But why would you then believe it? The reason why you would believe it is because you'd be faced by this question. Either the event occurred or it didn't occur. Now, if the event occurred, well, that's what people are reporting. But if it didn't occur, how did you, who and how were you able to get everybody that was there to affirm the story, and there's no dissenting opinion, to convince people to tell a story, and they tell the story, don't change after a few minutes. This story is a story that they tell to their children, and all the people that were there, there's not one dissenting opinion. How do you achieve a thing like that? So either you believe in mass conspiracies. Now, if you believe in mass conspiracies, so I want you to understand that you don't know anything. That there's no way of knowing anything, because maybe the fact that, how do we know that there was a Revolutionary War? Well, you don't know. It's just about history. Yeah, but so what? Maybe somebody wrote history books. 2 years ago, somebody, how do you know
How do you know that these issues are for good? People can like, there's many books that are false, the fact that it's in a book. The way you know it is, because this history book has been accepted by, wherever you go throughout America, that's the history that's being taught, that this history has been accepted by these people as a valid, legitimate account of what actually occurred. So then you have to ask yourself this question, well, did it occur or didn't it occur? If it did not occur, then how did you convince an entire nation to accept as the foundation of their history something that's never happened? That's so contrary to all our experience that people are not going to do that. No people are going to agree to accept something to accept as their history. Not in terms of teaching to their children that this is what we experience. Something which in point of fact they never did. Now, I maintain that that's the foundation, but that is an impossibility. It's impossible, and that's what it means to occur. It's never occurred. Other religions, or whatever other religions, millions and millions of believers, bear in mind that no other religion do you have a situation where a group of people are saying that they personally were there and witnessed the phenomenon. There was never a case of a mass revelation. All of the Christians accepted Christianity because they had the few guys, the apostles, whatever it was, and they convinced people that this occurred in a different place. But the Christians themselves don't testify that they themselves witnessed it. All they testify is that they believe what these people told them. That's something else. The fact that people believe something, the fact that people have faith in something, is absolutely no proof to the contrary. It doesn't give any authenticity. It's no proof that it occurred, because when in the realm of belief, people are the craziest people. So just because millions, see, when it comes to ideas, and when it comes to beliefs that people have, numbers is absolutely meaningless. To the contrary, the more people believe in something, the more suspicious you should be, because it's obviously, because most people don't use their mind. What we're saying, the validity of Hermon and Sinai is the testimony that they witnessed it. Now, if you take this, and I just want to say one more thing. Throughout history, there's been many charlatans, many false religious leaders, and even political leaders, that wanted to have the allegiance of the people. There were kings that ruled by divine right, that they claimed to have divine right. There were religious leaders. There was Hitler, Yirach Shemo. All of these individuals tried to convince mankind that they were acting with some kind of a higher dispensation. But did they ever appeal to the people and say, you have to follow me because you were there when God came down and commanded us to go on this course? How come there's not one religious leader in history that ever did such a thing, or would even try to do such a thing? And even today, people that claim that they have power, so it's all in secret. Let somebody come and make a claim that we all witnessed, we were there. And we witnessed when God came down and said the following. Now, why wouldn't somebody make a recourse to that? That would be a tremendously powerful tool. The answer is because people will reject it absolutely. Now, people can be manipulated, and people can be maneuvered into believing, but you cannot get people, especially large groups of people, to affirm that they witnessed an event which in point of fact never occurred. That I maintain is an impossibility. And it would be virtually impossible to convince even a small group like this that you were here today and you saw the tables being lifted and all kinds of miraculous phenomena come. Even a small group couldn't be convinced. But certainly a large group of hundreds of thousands of people would be convinced that's why this is here. Hundreds of thousands of people are testifying that this is their history. That they were gathered, and this site that we've described, the fire, the thick cloud, the sound of the shofar, and a voice from God proclaiming the Ten Commandments and establishing Moshe Rabbeinu.
Now, how is it possible that this became the basis of the history of the Jewish people? This was clearly accepted by the Jewish people, and they transmitted it from generation to generation. Now, you have two possibilities. Either it occurred, or it did not occur. If it didn't occur, how did anybody, at a certain point in time, somebody managed to get the people to accept this book, which gives a completely different history of their origins and their religion that's completely alien to them? Isn't it natural that these people would reject it and say, it's not true, it's not that easy? It would be like somebody were to come to America today and convince that there was never a revolutionary war, George Washington is a fiction, a completely different version of history. So the American people would absolutely reject it. So therefore, the fact that throughout Jewish history, there was never ever a movement that arose that this is false, this is not true, we don't have this history, we were never at Har Sinai and all that. You see in the rest of the Torah that whatever Moshe commands the Jews, there's rebellion against Moshe, there's disagreement, there's resistance, there's a lot of rebellion from the Torah, but never once do they say that it's not true, there was no Sinai. No one ever questioned that. So what we're saying over here is that by virtue of the fact that this story is found in the Torah. So of course the question is, how do you know that it's true? Because it's just a book. The fact that it's recorded in the Torah doesn't make it true, because the question is, how do I know the Torah is true? The answer would be that this entire nation accepted it as a valid account of their history, placed it on the same level as any other valid account of any other nation's history. So either you accept history or not. I'll tell you something else. It's interesting to note, you see another confirmation that the major religions of the world did not have any separate, their whole foundation, they didn't have any basis in terms of their own personal origin. Any miracle, everything goes. So why doesn't it start with the so-called Old Testament? Why didn't the Christians start completely separately? Why? And why didn't Islam? Why didn't it start? Every Islam also goes back to, everybody affirms the revelation of Sinai. Many of them want to say that there's changes, it wasn't, whatever, there's distortions. But in terms of origin, every religion of the world that's based upon revelation, any religion that's based upon revelation goes back to the so-called Old Testament. Why? Because it's impossible to start at the scratch. We are the only ones that have this phenomenon of a system which is established upon a public revelation which is uncontested. Which, again, how did it happen? Why couldn't another religion establish? That is something which can be fabricated. You can convince people to create a history that didn't happen. And it's not just based upon a relatively indifferent event. It's a very significant event, because if it's something which burdens you, so to speak, with commandments and obligations and so forth, and the whole history of the Jewish people. So there'd be a tremendous resistance to accepting it. As I said, I couldn't convince you to say that you saw something which is even irrelevant. Because you're not going to accept something that you didn't see. As a lie. It's a lie. But something which would be counter to your natural desire, why would you affirm something? Which means that you're bound by God and there's a covenant and you're going to have all kinds of obligations and so on and so forth. You see that in order to establish such a thing is an impossibility. It is impossible for anyone to establish a religion with a significant group of people. I'm not talking about two people. With a significant group of people that would be in the thousands, hundreds of thousands, it would be based upon the fact that these people testify, and they testify not just in that generation, but by passing down to their children this history. We were there in the sense that this is the history that we passed down generation to generation to generation. It had to be passed down generation to generation, because if it wasn't, then at a certain point in history, somebody would be trying to change the history. Then you'd have the conversion. Then you'd have people, the ones that wouldn't accept the inversion, saying it's a phony. That at a certain point in history, they tried to change our history, and we rejected it. Therefore, it's never been done. And that's what the Pasuk in Devarim means when it says, Sha'al no liyam nishan, study history. This is what you're supposed to study. The entire world. Go across the entire world. Go through all history. Hamiya kadavar agad lozed. Did such a thing ever happen? It never happened because it can't happen because it's an impossibility. So essentially what takes place with regard to the Jewish people, the establishment of a system, the establishment of a nation, which passes on from generation to generation a history which is based upon this event, is something which would be impossible to create. It's impossible to fabricate. That's why when God revealed the Torah to us, he did it in a manner which would prove beyond any doubt to an intelligent person. Now, of course, then there's all kinds of, when people hear this, then resistance says, then they say, well, maybe it was Martians, maybe all that stuff is absurd. If you get out of closet, Martians did the same thing. Maybe Martians convinced people like George Washington, or maybe that there was a British Boston Tea Party and so forth. All that is absurd. It was done, you can understand the beauty of what's taking place over here, the so-called orchestration. It was the will of God to set it up in a way which makes it true beyond any shadow of a doubt. There's not even any room for faith over here. This is knowledge. The mind is absolutely convinced that it must be the case because it is established on the firm principle by which we determine that things that we didn't witness, secondhand knowledge, we accept this, basically this principle of the universe. The idea of eliminating a mass conspiracy. That's why you get on an airplane. And you have no way directly of knowing whether it can fly, what condition it's in. But you're relying on many, many different people could not be fooled, could not be deceived. And if there was a deception, you hear about it. People would come running up and say, there's no engine movement on this plane. There's a whole system. Anytime a person, somebody would come out and make certain claims, immediately people investigate the claim. So it's impossible to establish something which is affirmed by masses of people, but in point of fact, it's a fabrication. And as I said, if you accept that possibility, then you can't base any, you can't live your life. And the only thing you can revive would be first-hand knowledge, which is very, very limited. It doesn't give you much room. So clearly, and nobody regards themselves as being irrational. To the contrary, it would be irrational to reject. The person that says, look, since I don't know the pilot, since I don't know the doctor, and so forth, I'm just going to live in a cave somewhere and just live myself to first-hand experiences, that person would be like, well, there's rationality dictates that the system works. You see that it works. There's a system here. And these are the basics of the system. So when you apply the rule by which we establish that it is rational to accept historical phenomena, World War II, everybody that was there, the entire world, accepts the fact that it was World War II. Interpretations, the causes, so forth, that's a matter of interpretation. That's not simple fact. The Six-Day War. Everyone accepts that the event occurred. The world will solve maybe as a conspiracy. How do you know that it happens? It's possible. The answer is, we regard that as being a practical impossibility. So, those are the essential criteria. As a person applies them to Torah and Sinai, then you come to the conclusion that it is something which would be absolutely impossible. Never has been done, never will be done, and that's why all the religions, as I said, harken back to our revelation, because that's the only one that is accepted. That is, the only case where a nation accepted the truth of a religious system based upon testimony that they witnessed, a public revelation.
The idea of what the purpose of the Ma'amad Har Sinai, or the so-called revelation is spelled out in greater detail in Devarim. Because in Devarim, Moshe Rabbeinu is reviewing certain aspects of Torah from the standpoint of giving the Jews the proper Musar, and the Tochacha, and the impact that it should have in terms of their life. He's presenting it more from the philosophical significance. So therefore, there are more details that are presented to us in Zohar, which are omitted in Shemos. Because in Shemos, it's just describing the event. But the fact that this event is significant and is to serve as the foundation is mentioned in the Pasuk in Shemos, when it says, when God tells him the reason. So that's very terse, but in one Pasuk, the objective of the revelation is established. And that is to say that an entire nation shall be witnesses. And that is the key. To just briefly review the major points, the uniqueness of the Torah, and the manner by which we know that it came about, that the origin of the Torah is in an event in which the Creator of the universe manifested himself and revealed the Aseres HaDibros and the basics of the system that he wants people to live by, is by virtue of the fact that he created witnesses. An entire nation became witnesses to the event, thereby rendering it something which cannot be challenged, which any rational person who understands what the factors are to determine whether a person should accept something as being true, any person that's operating with certain principles that determine what he embraces in terms of convictions would have to accept it. A way of looking at it is, if a person were to ask the question, well, how do I know that this is true, that God spoke to a people, then you could ask that person, well, what would the criteria be? What would the criteria be which would enable you to be convinced that it actually occurred? What type of criteria are you looking for? And the answer is, if you examine carefully what is being said over here, what the reality is, you have to come to the conclusion that what we find in the history of the Jewish people is something which would be impossible for anybody to fabricate, for anybody to engineer. There is no way in which you can convince people to profess that they have been witnesses to something which in point of fact they haven't been witnesses to. That's a impossibility, and whenever that would occur, if people claim to have witnessed something which we would have, you know, reason to suspect, one after we're not convinced of, then there's going to be all kinds of challenges. If something is not true, if something didn't happen, yet some people, they want to create some type of a scare. They want to claim that there's unidentified flying objects or anything along those lines. If that is the case, it's impossible to get unanimous agreement there'll always be different opinions.
People like to point to the example of this this actor, Orson Welles. And there was I don't know how many people have heard about it. There was a incident. He was on radio. He had a radio show years and years ago, probably before the television era. And he created some kind of a scare because he did it as a shtick.
The Martians.
That Martians were invading and so on and so forth. He was doing it as a joke, but he was a great actor and he was so convincing that people thought he was giving a real report.
He wrote the script and did it himself.
He wrote the script, he did it himself, and had you turned on the radio, the sense you would have gotten is that there's a real newscaster telling about some tremendous disaster that occurred. And many, many people were taken in by it, and it caused a certain type of a panic. So sometimes people, when they hear the exposition about Ptolemy Sinai, will say, well, you see, that it was did not occur, and yet he was able to convince people. To the contrary, that proves the impossibility, because in a very, very short period of time, people began to look into it, to discover what the source was, and the truth emerged, that he was just doing a shtick, and that nothing really had taken place.
He denied it the very next day.
Well, he denied it the very next day.
He created a national panic. People were jumping out of windows. They were afraid of being having a worse death than the Martians.
Yeah, that is something which we maintain is a impossibility. Even within the framework of a small group of people, to have a conspiracy that will actually work. You can have a conspiracy to lie. You can have people we mentioned that yesterday, in terms of eliminating the possible causes of error. That you have witnesses, and witnesses can testify that they saw something which in fact they didn't see. That's fine. That doesn't mean anything. Because there you're talking about a couple of individuals. And, of course, the authorities will do everything possible to interrogate them, to establish the truth. And sometimes they won't be able to refute them. So there will be cases where people can lie. But you're not going to have something in which a group of people are going to testify, you're going to convince them to testify, to assert that something occurred which, in point of fact, did not occur. That has never been the case. It's never been done in all of history. Now, there are certain misunderstandings that people have. For example, people think that the idea of the proof is that we're saying that so many people testify that it's true. That's not what we're talking about. And then they say, well, then there's millions of Christians that testify that the Christianity is true. That is not the idea behind the proof. It's not based upon how many people are going to maintain that something is true. Because as I said yesterday, the fact that people believe something is no indication whatsoever that it has any truth to it. And to the contrary, generally speaking, the more people believe in something, the more popular it is, the more of an indication that it's really not based upon any kind of truth. Because the majority of people's beliefs and convictions are determined by their feelings, by their emotions. So Judaism does not believe in that at all. To the contrary, that's the whole essence of Avraham, that Avraham be'ever ha'echad, that Avraham was on one side and the entire world was on the other side. Which means to say that in terms of truth, he discovered the truth, the reality, about the creator of the universe, and as opposed to the idolatrous constructions that people fabricated in their own mind, he was the only individual in his society, and virtually the only one, only a few people in the world knew about this truth. So that idea that people sometimes say, well, very often someone will have a very original idea which is extremely unconventional and it goes totally against the tide. So, and most people believe otherwise because that's the accepted truth. So it's very difficult for people to go against that, and they'll say, well, how is it possible that everybody else looks at it differently? You'll find that all the time, even in Judaism. If you have a interpretation of Judaism that's different than the mainstream, so to speak, or the conventional. So people have a hard time with that. Because what are you saying, that, oh, everybody's wrong? And we maintain that that's not an argument. Yes, could be. Whether the truth of an idea has nothing to do with the amount of people that believe in it. That's totally contrary to the Torah. We don't describe truth to numbers. Whether something is true or untrue has to do with the phenomena, with the facts, with the logic, with the analysis. And it's very, very possible. It's very, very possible. It's throughout all of history. It's the mankind has made progress because of great people who were independent and they went against the tide. And after centuries, it became clear that their idea was true. So the fact that you have millions of people believing in something is absolutely no proof whatsoever. Because that, we say, is extremely possible within the realm of the possible. To convince millions of people to go along with a system and to affirm that an individual has special powers, which is the Hindu religion, the Eastern religions with a Buddha, that they believe that he had some divine powers or he had some revelations. Well, whatever the case may be, so you'll say, well, how is it possible? You have millions, maybe billions of people that believe in that. Doesn't that prove something? I say absolutely not. Because that is something, their connection to Buddha or their is purely based upon belief. There is no claim. They have agreed to, for whatever reasons, then of course after the first generation, every other generation is raised in the brainwashed. Yeah, you have to understand also, when establishing a religion, the difficult thing is essentially in the first generation to convince enough people that we're not raised in it. So you're starting from scratch with these individuals, but to convince them to accept the claim that you're making. Now, if you could do that, then it becomes progressively easier because there's a certain mechanism that all religions utilize, and that is the indoctrination factor. And that's why you can have, like you have in our society today, extremely intelligent people, extremely rational, logical people in every area except in the religion, Christianity, for example. When it comes to that, they don't apply the same type of logical critique that they would apply in any other area. And they just accept on the basis of faith a system of ideas which is logically impossible. The fundamentals of Christianity is something which logic would reject. And they themselves acknowledge it, that it's absurd, that the views are absurd, but it's faith. That's all because of the power of indoctrination. You can really destroy a person's mind in childhood by closing the mind with regard to certain doctrines. And then there's the phenomenon of a certain type of religious guilt that you impose. And that's how all religions operate. There's no religion that bases itself upon an investigation that encourages an individual to investigate and only to accept the principles on the basis of using their mind. That's what I explained. You see that Yahadus is different because you say in the Tefillah, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. So the question that I had raised was, it should simply say Elokei Avraham, God of Avraham. Because Avraham is the one who made the discovery. He was raised in idolatry. So he was able to penetrate, to break through from the indoctrination, the enslavement of that type of an indoctrination. And he was able to free himself and to utilize his own intelligence and to operate purely on the basis of his intelligence. Now, one should say, if that's the case, that was God of Avraham. Well, Yitzhak received it from his father, and then Yaakov received it from his father. So why does it say Elokei Yaakov as though he too made a discovery? And just very briefly, the answer to that is that Avraham did not employ the system of indoctrination. That he related to them in terms of guiding them on an investigation, so that they should partake of this investigation and to analyze and to study the criteria and to allow them to arrive at the correct conclusion through the utilization of their own free will. So that's Elokei Yitzhak. Yitzhak also came to that conclusion. So that's a totally different concept. And therefore, the fact that all religions can claim that they have millions of people that believe in it, you see, well, that's why the idea of proselytizing is vital to all the other religions. All the other religions are operating on the principle that numbers have a certain significance in determining the authenticity, in determining truth. That's why it's extremely important for the Christians to proselytize. The more people believe in it, the more they can feel secure that it's true. And we reject that idea completely. Of course, the most important target of the proselytizing is the Jews themselves, because they know that the Jews are the ones to whom the revelation was given. And the Jews are the big holdouts and say that everything you're claiming is absolutely false. So that's why the Jews have always been the target of proselytizing. So let's just make it clear. The foundation of Torah Mi-Sinai and the fact that this story, as recorded in the Torah, is attested to by hundreds of thousands of people, is we accept that as a verification, because what they're saying is that they witnessed phenomena, that at a certain point in time the entire nation was gathered at Sinai and they witnessed the phenomena that is described in the Torah, which could leave no doubt whatsoever that the Supreme Being was communicating with them. That's the foundation of our system, and there is no other people that makes that kind of a claim. And as I'm trying to explain, there's a good reason for that, and that is because it's an impossibility to create this type of a phenomenon. It's an impossibility to convince masses of people that they witnessed something, which would be very favorable to you if you could convince them. As I said, no religious charlatan, no political leader who wanted millions of people to believe in him, to believe that he had some divine dispensation. They can only operate on other different types of methods to try and manipulate people's emotions. Yeah, you could have a Hitler Yamashima who had millions of Germans believing in him. But he could not get them to do so on the basis of a claim that they themselves were witnessed when some supernatural event occurred. And they couldn't do it. No other individual ever even attempted to do it because he'd get left out of the box. It's an impossibility. You don't have that kind of control. And even in Soviet Russia, with all the control, with all the propaganda, no one ever managed to establish something like that, that people would actually testify that they themselves witnessed an event which was supernatural in nature and which would prove beyond doubt that they have to follow a certain doctrine, and that they would then teach their children and pass on this truth. A whole nation would pass on a history that they themselves had witnessed, to pass it on to their children, to the next generation. This phenomenon has never, ever occurred in history. The phenomenon that we find in Judaism, that the Jewish people has always maintained the Torah as being an accurate description of what took place, of what their origins were. The events in Egypt and so on and so forth. All the events of the Torah now become compelling because this is the history that was, no one can question it. There's no one that doubts that the Jews accepted the Torah. This entire nation accepted the Torah. There's no one that denies that. But they fail to see the implications of what this means, because again, you got to get back to the same basic point. Did these events occur or did they not occur? And if you maintain that they did not occur and the entire thing is fiction, then what you have to say is that at a certain point in time, some individual was able to achieve something which has never ever been able, which I've just demonstrated is an impossibility, would come to this people and somehow or other manage to convince an entire people to accept a new history of itself. In other words, it was a different history of the Jews, not the history that you read. And at a certain point in time, somebody entered into the picture and was able to convince the entire people to give up whatever history they had and to accept a completely different history. That, we say, is an impossibility. Nobody ever tried it. If somebody did try it, and maybe convinced two people, you definitely would be hearing an argument. There definitely would have to be some kind of a record from those who disagreed. Or there was a war broke out and they were killed, whatever the case may be. So, again, it's important to realize what the foundation of our belief that the origin of the Torah is not something which people just believed in because you had a charismatic individual and he claimed it was from God and people believed that of him. Not the case. The entire nation witnessed this event and made this a part of their history, which was transmitted to the entire nation. And there's not one voice of dissent has been recorded. Not one faction that says it didn't occur. There's been different factions among the Jews in terms of like the Tzedukah, about the Torah Shebastav, Torah Shebalpeh, that type of an issue. Because that's fine, because to have such a thing, because that is not something which is visible. That's something you can argue about. That, but even the Tzedukim did not deny the divinity of the Torah. That they didn't deny. But how it should be interpreted? That's something which it's possible for people who want to distort the situation. I explained to you yesterday why a person is intelligent. If he's rational, he has to assume that there's a Torah Shebaal Peh as well. But the fact that you have an argument concerning that is not any kind of a disproof, because the proof of the matter is that all these groups accepted the divinity of the Torah Shebachsav. That you can't argue. Yeah, well, we're so that we're all Tcheles, and they ridiculed his answer, but they didn't deny Torah Sinai. Or in the FK, you have a Shayim that wanted to live an instinctual life, and they chose not to be rational about the Torah. That doesn't disprove. That does not disprove. That the only question is, and the same question you can ask today, there's Reformed Jews today that deny the Torah. So the question is, what went wrong in terms of the educational system that would convince them? How did this occur? But there's no way you can undo a historical event. There's no way you can undo a historical event. There's no way that you can prevent people from sinning as long as they retain emotions and they have free will. Then it's a personal battle. If God were to, again, orchestrate a revelation, public revelation, to millions and millions of people throughout the world, and they were all convinced on that day that this was from God, that would be no guarantee that in a very short amount of time they could be acting totally contrary to what they know to be true. Because the only thing that protects a person is if he studies Torah. Let's ask ourselves the question, why do we have to, well, God revealed himself, so why do you have to give all the mitzvot, and why do you have to give all the commands to study the Torah, and to do tshuva, and to work on yourself? Because if the fact that you're convinced that God appeared, if you don't internalize that, yeah, that's why miracles, that's another weakness in miracles. A person can experience the most powerful miracle, and it's going to wear off, the effect is going to wear off. If he does not internalize it, if you don't internalize it, and uproot the emotions that are opposed to it and work on yourself and achieve perfection, you're going to be an imperfected individual. If you're an imperfected individual, you're going to operate in accordance with your emotional desires. That's why Moshe warned them. This is the foundation, as we said, this is the foundation. But didn't I also say that what does this have to lead to? Na'aseh v'nishma. If you don't act on it, I'm giving you something that if you use your intelligence, you'll be able to see that it comes from me. This book comes from me. But if you don't act on it and you just ignore the book, and you don't do what the book commands, which is not an easy task. You have to study. You have to do the mitzvahs. You have to work on yourself. You have to be constantly on God. You have to wear tzitzis. What's the tzitzis? So you should be constantly reminded of this truth. If you don't do these things, so then, the whole effect of the Ma'amad Har Sinai is going to be lost. Ma'amad Har Sinai is there for an intelligent person, like the Ibn Ezra says, for the Torah was given to Chachamim. And you see in every area, you could have the greatest handbook, guidebook on any area, medicine, on other areas of human concern. It doesn't matter. And everybody can be completely convinced that this is the road. This is the right road. But if you don't study the book, if you don't internalize and live by it, so then you're not going to get the benefit of it. So that's what Moshe said. This is the starting point. Sinai is the starting point. But Sinai in and of itself is not a magical pill. And therefore the nation has to act on that. I've given you the benefit of Atah Reishis Hadas. That's why he keeps telling him, now Shemar Nafshecha Ma'od, and don't forget what you saw, and implement it, and build on it, and until you reach the level where you are keeping it because you recognize the benefits and you see the truth. But if you don't do that, then of course you're going to sin. Of course you're going to want to serve Avodah Zarah. They're very powerful emotions. So Sinai itself is no guarantee that people are going to be perfected. It's the starting point for perfection. But whether or not it'll lead to that, you see, whether or not it'll lead, the sins that the Jews committed were not an indication of the fact that the foundation wasn't strong enough, wasn't authentic enough. You don't see anything like that. They're very, very authentic, very powerful. But now, what do you do next? Where do you go from there? I think the fact that a person believes in something, is convinced about something, and something is part of their values, is not a guarantee that they never will sin or even violate the terms. People will violate the terms of their marriage. People can be believers of Torah, and they can get caught up. That's the human condition, that you always have to be on guard. And that's why you'll find religious leaders, even righteous people. And the Tanakh describes many righteous people that committed averos and many serious averos. David HaMelech, for example, and others who were righteous people. Are we going to say that, well, you see David sinned, so therefore he obviously didn't accept the Torah? That's absurd. It means to say that that's a different issue. That as long as you're human, you're under the sway of a different principle where there could be a tremendous gap between your knowledge of the good, your knowledge of reality, and your emotional desire of the moment, and therein lies the human battle, the Milchemes HaChayim, the war of life. And there is absolutely nothing in the behavior of the Jews or of individuals that could in any way, shape, or form make any change whatsoever with regard to the fact that the nation itself, if you study the history of this event, there's no question that you have to accept this event as being authentic. Now, will the nation act upon that? That's the whole challenge of Jewish history, Nasa v'Nishma. That's what God is saying. I've given you the opportunity. I've made it clear to you. But if you don't work on this every day, if you don't take this, and that's why Lo Tishkach, that's the warning of Moshe Rabbeinu. If you allow yourselves to become complacent, Moshe Rabbeinu is warning the Jews that this is just the beginning, it's just the foundation. And if you don't effectuate a change, if you don't perfect yourselves, if you don't follow all of the mitzvot and all of the reminders, then it will fade away like anything else. It'll be just a minimal experience. Like, people experience miracles, foxholes. There's no atheist in the foxhole. People go through tremendous experiences and then where they were on the verge of being killed, soldiers, and through the craziest set of circumstances, they were somehow saved and all their comrades died, and they're convinced that it's a miracle. Convinced that it's a miracle. You've heard this, you've all heard people who are convinced that it had to be a miracle. Does this mean that 5 years later they're living perfected life? Because at the moment they were convinced, they gave tremendous hodayah, tremendous praise, acknowledgement, thanksgiving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And they were convinced that their whole life is going to be changed. So the question is, if a person experiences an event which creates a very powerful sense that God has done something for him, and in that moment of time, He's fully convinced, committed that he's going to keep the Torah and so on and so forth. Is that, can we, on the basis of that, can we be sure that 5 years later this person will be leading a righteous existence? No. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. The key question is, what does he do with the experience? If he allows that experience to just operate on its own, and it'll fade away. Because it's not, there's no automatic change. The old, the structure of a human being and all of his emotional desires and his fears, everything, unless it's going to be upgraded, reoriented on the basis of the knowledge, then he's going to be the same person, and the effect will wear off. So the effect of Sinai can wear off too. But it never wore off in terms of the nation. It never wore off because it became a permanent fixture in the life of the nation. So therefore, how is that possible? Now, is the nation living up? Is it aware of its own history? Is it living up to the implications of its own historical truth? Unfortunately not. There's always a segment. I mean, those are the ones who keep the Torah. There is a segment. But that doesn't change anything. Because there's no way you can refute history. You can't change history. There's no way today that anybody can change the history of the United States that did not originate from the Revolutionary War. It can't be changed. It's there. The testimony is there. It's established. And no way it can be changed. Can't go back and change it. There's no way you can change the account of the event of Sinai. The oracle knowledge. That was, I think, one of the first philosophers to formulate it that way was the Khuzari. So bear in mind, a lot of people say, well, if that's the case, how come as many Jews today don't believe in the Torah? Well, the answer is they don't understand what the proof is. They haven't thought about it. So they just think that it's something that's in a book. It's basically the way we were all raised. When you read the Parsha in the Torah, you'd think, well, okay, that's the Torah.
That's the story.
That's the story. It's a story. Well, but do I know that the story really occurred? And you didn't make the logical connections on the basis of the fact that there's criteria by which we accept things in history. So there are many people that are not aware of what we're talking about. They just think it's a book, and the book was accepted by a lot of people, and it's no different. They don't see it as being any different than Christianity, except its stories, its miracles. So you accept this miracle. They didn't recognize the difference that over here what you have is witnesses. Masses of people testifying that they were the ones who were there, that they actually saw it. Yet, when you try and give this exposition, there are still people that really refuse to accept it. And you have to understand, the emotions play a very significant role. And I think the psychologists call it some kind of a cognitive dissonance. That is, that when it comes to this area, there are very strong resistances that people do not want there to be any type of a proof because they don't like to read the results. The results imply, I mean, if you accept it as being true, so then it's a whole different universe that you're living in. Until, without the proof, so you have a certain psychological freedom. Even religious people don't like it because they like the idea that we're having faith. They think they're doing God a favor by having faith. But it also provides a certain freedom. You don't have to feel that bound by it. It removes a lot of guilt because I'm not even sure if it's true. So there's a very strong desire amongst many religious people, just like non-religious people, that the Torah should be something which is in a different realm. It's, as I explained to you at the outset, this is assimilation. It's a result of assimilation that the Torah should be in a realm where it's something that we really can't say for sure that it's true. Because once you are committed, once it's very clear to you that it's from God, you kind of don't have too much room. You don't have any space. You've got to keep it. What choice do you have? Therefore, the atheist will make up all different types. He can't deny the basics. Nobody can deny the basics that you are obligated to come to the conclusion that masses of people testify that they saw this. So then they start to make up all kinds of concoctions. Well, how do you know it was really from God? Maybe they were Martians. Maybe Moshe was able to hypnotize the people and so forth. Or even what we heard the other day, that maybe Moshe was able to conjure something and they heard some kind of... All of these things, which essentially are denials. That is, if you're going to say that, bear in mind, if you're going to say that maybe they were confused, Maybe somebody faked them out. Maybe this, maybe that. If all of these things are essentially saying we have to deny that this group of people had any ability to ascertain on the basis of their sense perceptions what reality was. You're saying these people had no ability to ascertain reality. First of all, that's absolutely absurd. You're talking about people, but it's not just people. I mean, the Jews have been known throughout history to be an astute people. And a stubborn people, and a rebellious people. And so how can you get this entire group of people to tell the story? But if that is the case, if you're going to maintain that, then I say that you have to reject all of history. Because why don't you say the same thing about any event? Why don't you say that you could always find conspiracies? There are people that have conspiracies. You could say that there was a conspiracy to convince people that there was a war. A conspiracy. Because there is no way, as I said, that anybody can experience firsthand World War I. There's no way you could do it. You're going to have to rely on other people's testimony. Even a soldier that was in Europe at that time, he didn't see World War I or he didn't see World War II. He just lay within a fight. The fact that all, fitting in the missing pieces, that this was part of a worldwide thing, and all the different alliances and so on and so forth, no one person witnessed that. That comes together from many, many people testifying. That while you were there, you other people testified that they were, if a person was in Japan in World War II, how did he know he was part of World War II? Which engulfed the entire world. All he saw was one little battle. So man, he doesn't even know where he was. How did he know he was in Japan? You can say this was all a conspiracy. So if you're going to, now nobody, no sane person is going to seriously put forth these things. Therefore, there is nothing that an atheist can do except to start to break down the essential categories and to posit. Yeah, because I told you yesterday that anything is possible. You can say whatever you want. You can say it's possible. You could say, if you were there, if you witnessed Kriya Shamsuf, you could say it's possible that there were forces of nature and so on and so forth that caused them to split, and then the water came together, and it was just good luck that the Jews were the ones that were saved and they were drowned. You can say whatever you want to say. You can twist any set of facts in any manner you want, but that is distortion. The atheists essentially will have to engage in a distortion. And because there's no way that you can deny the fact that this group of people is testifying that this is what they saw. That's as far as you need to go, by the way. That is to say that the story which the Torah describes over here is something which you have to accept as being true. That true in the sense that this people are saying, you can't get past that. When we say you accept it as true, we're accepting the account as it is presented to us in the Torah, that an entire nation is telling us that they were there. Meaning to say, you are in the position, let me see if I can create a better example. You are in the position today. Let's say that you had 2 million Jews in the land of Israel. And let's say that a similar thing occurred. At Obishvos, 2 million, 3 million Jews, let's say all the Jews in Israel, let's put it that way, or all the people in Israel, were gathered together at the site of the Kotel. And the same things occurred. The fire went up to heaven and the thick clouds and the shofar, and they heard the voice from heaven proclaiming that the Torah is true, and revelation. Now, we were not there. We were here. And all these people came and told us that we can get them into a room, an amphitheater, whatever the case may be. And they all told us that this is what they saw, and there's not one, whether they're kibbutznik, religious, chiloni, whatever you want to call it, all said the same story. That's what we saw. So, what would be the logical conclusion? wouldn't you be forced to conclude that everything that they're saying is true? That this, and then you'd have to examine whether what they claim, there's no doubt anymore that this actually happened. Now the only question would be whether what they're actually saying has any significance to it. Is this incontrovertible proof that a supreme being communicated with them? That's the situation in which we find ourselves with regard to Sinai, that this occurred to a group of Jews in one generation, millions of Jews, and it's as though we're not there. They're telling it to us. As though the same thing I just mentioned right now, that over Shavuos, all of Israel claimed that they were united at the Kotel. And if and you have the same question, you have to accept that it occurred, because are you going to believe that the leftists and the non-religious and the atheists were somehow duped into telling the story? Everybody's telling the same story. So then you have to accept that it actually occurred. And then all that would remain was to evaluate, okay, well, what does it imply, though? I can't deny that it happened, but what's the implication? That's what the significance of the Sinai story is. As far as the question raised by Mark about backsliders, the amazing thing is that you never find any instance in the Torah or even in Tanakh or any kind of a movement that rebelled against Judaism, rebelled against Moshe on the basis that the whole thing is nonsense, that it never happened. Our parents never told us this, that you never. But the event of Torah Misinai does not obliterate the human psyche. People still have free choice. And people still have very, very powerful emotions. So therefore, when they encountered difficulties in the wilderness and they became weary, and then they'd rebel. And then they would distort. But they didn't deny the Torah. They would complain that Moshe Rabbeinu was making mistakes, that he's leading us to destruction, this can't be the will of God. Things of that sort. Under the pressure of fears, anxieties, the Meraglim. The Meraglim, when they came to the land, they were overcome by fear. They didn't then go back and deny the Torah. But they allowed themselves to be overcome by their emotions, and there was an avera. The phenomenon of Torah Misinai is not designed to prevent people from sinning. You need free will. And even a person that's absolutely convinced of Torah will sin. It says in Koheles that there's no person that lives in this world that only does good and doesn't sin. Even a person that believes in the Torah sins, because that's just the way the psyche functions, that there's always a clash. Just because a person knows that something is harmful doesn't mean he's not going to do it. People know that smoking is harmful doesn't mean they're not going to smoke. People know that alcoholism is dangerous doesn't mean they're not going to do it. That's a different issue. But as I said, there's plenty of areas in life where a person can rebel. But you do not find that anybody ever rebelled against the foundation and claimed that it didn't occur. Any avera that the Jews committed in history, even Avodah Zarah, does not in any way weaken the basis of the proof. Because the proof, once the entire people testifies that they were at Sinai, so that means that the event occurred. You have to accept the event as occurring. That's something else. The fact that people in that time or future generations, will they live in accordance with what they know to be true, or will they backslide, is a different issue. That does not in any way detract from the testimony. It would be like people testify that they directly witnessed some type of a hazard, some type of a danger. And there's no reason to doubt their story. And then you'll see that they themselves, and therefore on the basis, because of what they witnessed, they're issuing certain warnings that you shouldn't do certain things. And then it could be that people, we hear it and we can't doubt it, so we take it seriously. Then you can see that these very same people are engaging in the behavior, which they themselves are the source for the warning not to engage in it. So they're not being consistent. The fact of the matter is that there's no subsequent behavior which indicates that the Jews abandoned the Torah. There was great sinning, and there were sinners amongst the Jews, and there were deniers amongst the Jews. There's no question about that, because these are individuals who were overcome by their emotions, and when they're overcome by their emotions, so they distorted it, and they said that the Moshe made a mistake on certain points. This distortion. This could not be the intention of the Torah. For example, like Korach, this week's Parsha Korach. You know that whole Chazal that they came to Moshe with these talis.